So it's 9 o'clock. We are going to convene the meeting this morning, October 8th. So good morning and welcome to everybody. Thank you for being with us here today in person, and those of you who are online, also welcome. Thanks for being here. This is a hybrid meeting, which includes a physical meeting location here at the Central Coast Water Board Hearing Room at 895 Arrow Vista Place. And there's also an option for online remote participation through the Zoom webinar platform. If you would like to watch and listen to the meeting, the Water Board's customary website is also available. We will be receiving information from hearing participants and public comment, both in person and virtually. The Zoom meeting link has been made available along with the public speaker online request form through the website meeting participation page. If you are a remote presenter or member of the public who would like to make a comment, you should already be in the Zoom meeting webinar and attending using the meeting link provided on the board's website. You should also have submitted an online speaker request form if you plan on speaking. Requests to provide public comments for items on today's agenda will be accepted up to the start of each agenda item. If you wish to comment on an item and have submitted, excuse me, and it's not submitted a public comment request card, please do so now by either submitting an online comment request card through the remote meeting link located on the agenda. For those of you who are physically present at this hearing location, blue comment cards are located at the back of the room, and you may submit a comment card, or you may also scan the QR code, which is at the back of the room. If you are having trouble accessing the online meeting link, online speaker request form, or the webcast link, please contact the current clerk of the board at rb3-commentletters@waterboards.ca.gov. Remote presenters and speakers will be on mute with cameras turned off. Once it's your time to speak, you will be asked to unmute yourself and turn on your camera if you have one. When you're done with your comments and the board members have completed their questions, you will again be placed on mute and your camera will be turned off. You are welcome to remain in the Zoom meeting webinar as an attendee for the duration of the meeting. You may also exit the Zoom webinar and follow the webcast. This meeting and all Water Board meetings are recorded. So please speak slowly and clearly. We at the Water Board would like to acknowledge that all lands and waters within the Central Board are unceded tribal ancestral lands and waters. We acknowledge the historical wrongdoings committed against California Native American tribes, actions taken at this hearing, and those actions throughout the Central Coast Water Boards are in a hope of advancing the collective goal of truth and healing. Thank you for being here again, for listening, and we will now move to a roll call vote.
Chair Gray?
Present.
Vice Chair Wolf?
Present.
Member Hunter?
Present.
Member Rodriguez?
Here.
Member Hoskins?
Present.
Member Harlan?
Present.
And Ms. Harlan is joining remotely today. We have an in-person quorum, so we can move forward with the meeting. I will now turn it over to our Executive Officer, Mr. Lodge.
Thank you, Chair Gray. My name is Ryan Lodge. I'm the Executive Officer for the Central Coast Water Board. I'll be going through some staff introductions this morning. Start with our temporary clerk to the board and Assistant Executive Officer, Taya Tryon. We have our legal counsel, Sophie Froelich. We have our three section managers here today, Harvey Packard, Angela Schroeder, and Mary Hamilton. We also have some staff introductions today. I'd like to introduce Amber Selinger, the senior engineering geologist. She'll be introducing some new staff in her site cleanup and DOD unit.
Good morning, Chair Gray, Vice Chair Wolf, and members of the board. I'm Amber Selinger. I'm the DOD program manager, as Ryan said, and I'm here today to introduce Anthony Schutz. He's our most recent hire, and he's working on site cleanup program projects. He's a licensed professional geologist, and he has a master's in geology from San Jose State. He has over 20 years of environmental consulting and also did some work at the county as well. So he's got a lot of experience bringing to us, and he's quickly coming up to speed on site cleanup program cases. So welcome, Anthony.
Welcome, Anthony. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Amber.
Next, I'd like to have Joey Sisk from our Land Disposal and Active Oil Field Program, the program manager, come up and introduce new staff.
Good
We have two new staff members.
We do. <Yeah. laughs> This is Luke and Jeff. Good morning, Chair Gray, members of the board. I'd like to introduce Jeff Whitson, a new engineering geologist with the Active Oil Fields Program. He started with us a few months ago this year, and he is a licensed California geologist and comes to us from CalGEM, a department of the California Department of Conservation. They're the primary oil and gas regulatory agency, where he has worked for nearly the last 5 years as an engineering geologist performing oil and gas regulatory work. He brings extensive database and statistical analysis experience using software, including Python, and he previously worked as a geologist for the Army Corps of Engineers and Mesa Biological and served over 10 years in the United States Marine Corps Reserves. And he brings with him his service dog, Luke, as well. Thank you. Well, excited to welcome Jeff.
Welcome, Jeff and Luke. Thank you so much.
Next, we'd like to introduce Melissa Doherty. She's our CCAMP program manager, and she will introduce staff at Bay Foundation.
Good morning, Chair Gray and members of the board. My name is Melissa Doherty. I'm the Senior Environmental Scientist Specialist in the Regional Monitoring and Assessment Programs here at the Central Coast Water Board. I'd like to take this opportunity to introduce our new CCAMP staff member, Isabel Kent. Isabel is originally from Connecticut, but came to us from Santa Cruz, where she worked as a Parks Service Officer for Santa Cruz County Parks Department with a primary assignment at Pinto Lake County Park in Watsonville. Isabel has a Bachelor of Science in Biology with an emphasis in Conservation Biology and Ecology from St. Mary's College. As some of you are already aware, the Central Coast Water Board implements the Central Coast Ambient Monitoring Program, or CCAMP, in partnership with the Bay Foundation of Morro Bay. The Bay Foundation hired Isabel in June of this year to fill a brand new position, which is a full-time position with CCAMP as a monitoring coordinator to help manage the CCAMP surface water monitoring field activities and oversee our field team. Isabel brings a great amount of experience and skills to our CCAMP program, and we're very excited to have her join our team and help implement our regional monitoring programs. And I'd like to say welcome to Izzy and have you please welcome her too.
Welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Should have preface that we have a lot of introductions because we haven't had a meeting in San Luis Obispo since February. Next, going to introduce Angela Schroeder, section manager. She's going to introduce some of our new student hires.
Good morning. Angela Schroeder, a supervising engineering geologist. I am really pleased to introduce Sierra Greninger. Sierra comes to us as a student in the Environmental Earth and Soil Science program at Cal Poly. She's a fourth year. She's also minoring in GIS, Geographic Information Systems. And she will have a unique role that we're trying this time, which is a scientific aid to serve our entire section. So that would be all of our groundwater protection and regional monitoring programs. And fun fact about Sierra, she spent the summer in Germany working on a project that manufactures affordable solar desalination machines. So welcome to Sierra.
Willkommen, Sierra.
Next, I'd like to introduce Elaine Saul, our Irrigated Lands Program Manager and Senior Environmental Scientist. You can introduce new staff.
Good morning, Chair Gray, Vice Chair Wolf, members of the board. My name is Elaine Saul, and I'm the Irrigated Lands Program Manager here today to introduce Enoch Krasick. He hails from Pennsylvania, and he has a bachelor's in biology. While in Pennsylvania, he also managed the operation, treatment, and regulatory compliance for many municipal drinking water systems. We're happy to have him in the Irrigated Lands Program as an environmental scientist. He's already gotten quickly up to speed, assisting growers, working with technical assistance providers, as well as coordinating with our third-party program. And he's been with our program now since March. So welcome, Enoch.
Welcome, Enoch. Thank you.
Last but not least, we have Mary Hamilton, section manager, supervising environmental scientist. She'll introduce not really new staff, but a staff in a new position.
You'll notice that James Bishop is joining us via Zoom, and it's my pleasure to introduce him in his new role as the Senior Engineering Geologist Technical Specialist. And in this role, James will lead our efforts to facilitate the development of the alternative water supply program for agricultural areas where residents are relying on domestic wells contaminated by ag activities. He's also going to be working on some of our organization's most technically complex and high-priority groundwater projects, and he'll facilitate cross-program and interagency coordination to ensure our work is aligned with our commitment to the Human Right to Water Law and also the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act. I shouldn't write the acronyms here. I should spell them out so I say them out. James is a licensed professional geologist. He's worked with us here at the Central Coast Water Board for over 7 years now and has worked in various programs. When he started in the cannabis program, he was also helping us to develop some of the groundwater-related portions of Ag Order 4.0. And in recent years, he's worked with our WDR program and acted as a liaison for us with select groundwater sustainability agencies throughout our region. James came to us from the USGS, and prior to that, he earned his bachelor's degree in geology and geophysics and a master's degree in hydrogeology, both from the University of Hawaii at Manoa. James is joining us from his home in Los Osos, home office, I should say, where he lives with his wife and two young children. And we are very happy to have him on our team and working on these high priority projects. Please join me in welcoming James.
Thanks, James.
Yeah, thanks, Mary, and thanks all.
That's it for staff introductions. So we will now want to introduce, move into item 20.
Yeah, that's fine. Strategic plan discussion.
Yes, strategic plan discussion. So we're going to, this is Ryan Lodge, Executive Officer. We're going to talk about our strategic plan and updates that we've made since the August 2023 board meeting when we first presented the strategic plan to the board. After the August meeting, we made some minor revisions to the plan based on board member feedback. We tried to strike a more positive tone related to workforce planning and our evolving work environment based on that discussion. The strategic plan is really a tool for us to set our priorities and manage our work. It's also a tool for the board to help inform discussions about projects and how they fit into our priorities. The plan consists of a narrative describing our changing work environment, our commitment to collaboration and public service, and it also includes four broad regional priorities. Slide. Those priorities include workforce planning and development, programmatic functions, climate adaptation and resilience, and environmental justice. The plan also includes background information about the Water Board's authority and mandate, administrative structure, physical setting, and water quality issues towards the back of the plan. Today we're going to focus on regional priorities, and in particular workforce planning and development, and programmatic functions. Environmental justice and climate resilience and adaptation are critical initiatives that we input or that are part of our everyday work. We discuss those in most of our programmatic work. We have environmental justice updates on an annual basis. And so although we are not going to be discussing those today, they are critical to our success in this organization. As part of the programmatic functions priority, our program managers, in coordination with program managers, develop program priorities for every program that we have in the organization. Prioritizing our work is critical in terms of managing our workload and managing staff's stress levels. Program priorities include, we can go to the next slide, a brief program narrative or description, staff resources. It includes general program priorities, some specific and task-specific priorities, and then also state board performance targets for the programs that do have those targets. Those don't include, not all programs have state level targets. Program managers did provide a mid-year fiscal year update, the 2023-2024 priorities. And an end-of-year update. We did those internally. We talked about the various tasks and priorities and also accomplishments for each program. The, sh- The strategic plan in front of you today includes the fiscal year 24-25 program priorities, and that's what we'll be discussing. I do want to provide an update on the state budget, because that does impact our workload and our priorities. The Department of Finance issued two budget letters this year at the beginning of the fiscal year in July, one of which required the reduction, a vacancy reduction of 10,000 positions statewide. That equates to five positions within our organization. So we had five positions swept at the beginning of July. The second budget letter involved an 8% programmatic reduction for every state agency, including ours. State Water Board is working with the Department of Finance to define what those reductions are going to mean for our organization. It could come in the form of program cuts, contract reductions, or a combination of the two. Layoffs and furloughs are not on the table at this time. It would come in the form of most likely more vacancy reductions and contract reductions. As a result, though, we have been, our hiring has been on, put on pause. We have 12 vacancies currently. It's a significant impact on our organization and an impact on what we can get done in the coming year. And I did want to emphasize that these cuts are significant. They're going to impact our ability to do our work. They will be permanent once they are finalized, and they will impact us for several years to come. So it just puts an emphasis on prioritizing our work. That's even more critical. We have fewer resources to get the work that we have done. As tasks and requests come in, we do need to be more effective in how we prioritize and discuss those priorities with program managers to determine how to shift those priorities. You could see that yesterday when we were talking about our the triennial review, discussing having an 18-month update. We have to balance that. I think we came to a good compromise to include some language in an executive officer's report. We have not adjusted this year's program priorities yet because we don't know the full extent of the cuts. We will work with the program managers at the mid-year check-in and end of year to make those adjustments. We do not expect that the programs will meet all of our priorities this year, and that's okay because we do not have enough resources to do that. We want to make sure we're not pushing staff and program managers too hard to do work that really is above and beyond. As I mentioned yesterday, we're under-resourced during good times, and these are not good times right now.
Yes, Dr. Wolf. Mr. Lodge.
So, Mr. Question. Lodge, big picture question. What is then our current total full-time staff count? And then, if my memory serves me right, we have about six interns?
We have scientific aides and students. I don't have a head count on that right off the top of my head. I don't know. We have seven, so, maybe.
It's eight. Seven or eight. Eight.
Yes. Eight. Total staffing is about, I think, about 84 if we had all the positions filled. We currently have 12 vacant positions. So right now we're working at about 70 to 72 staff.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure. So today we're going to have our section managers. They're going to be providing high-level overviews of the program priorities for each program. The program priorities discussions will be in the order that they appear in the strategic plan. So to start off, we will have Harvey Packard.
Before we do that, can you speak a little bit more to how the budget sort of targets certain programs as well? Are we going to have that conversation?
We don't have specifics on that
yet.
That discussion is going on between within the State Water Resources Control Board. They're taking a strategic approach in looking at different programs, but they haven't said for sure which programs are going to be potentially cut. There are discussions going on with the Department of Finance to try to minimize those cuts, so I wouldn't want to say right now and have that be inaccurate. We do get updates weekly with our weekly executive call, but it's been it's been going on for a while. I mean, we haven't been able to hire for 3 months now.
Right.
So, you know, quarter of our way into the fiscal year, it's a significant impact for us.
But there might be disproportionate impacts to particular programs. Is that
correct?
An accurate statement?
There could be.
Okay, thank you. Yes, Dr. Wolf.
So quite often when looking at budget shortfall, it adds further scrutiny to the fee structures for all the various permits. Is there any discussion as part of Department of Finance and at state board level reviewing the fee structures for the various programs that the Water Board has?
Yeah, they review those annually. There's a fees unit at the State Water Resource Control Board. We can provide comments during that process, but we're not really part of that process for setting those fees. I don't know if they're having those discussions specifically for the fiscal year 24-25 budget shortfalls.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, Dr. Hunter.
Thank you. We do receive federal money from USCPA, correct?
Correct, yes. Some of our programs are federally funded.
So is there a match required, or would that affect the federal monies in any way, reducing the funding we receive annually?
It should not reduce that. These are state funds that are being cut, and the federal funds will continue to come in and fund our positions. Okay. In whatever federal program, whether it's 401 or NPDES, that funding is not slated to be reduced.
Okay, that's good to hear.
Thank you. And I know you know, but we are not general fund. We are completely fee-driven.
Yes.
And federally funded.
Right.
Yeah. Right, but we are still subject to the cuts.
Yes. Okay, so we'll have Harvey Packard, section manager, going through first program.
Thank you, Mr. Lodge. Little background here. So we're going to have one slide for each program, and the three section managers will be alternating, going in the same order as the programs are discussed in the written strategic plan. But we'll be focusing on these slides on project priorities for this current fiscal year. And yeah, feel free to interrupt at any time with questions or comments.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I am curious about the order of mm-hmm. the programs. I looked at it and I didn't see a like number of staff at the top or indicating priority or alphabetical. So what does the sequence indicate?
I don't think it means anything.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just wondering.
Random.
I think
just
Jennifer
random.
Handed in her report quickest.
Okay, I like that. I'll keep that in mind.
Yeah, there's no rhyme or reason to the order. It's not in any type of priority. All okay. of our programs are critical. So.
Okay. And how many programs do we have total?
There's 22.
20, 22?
I counted 23, but 23. We'll see.
Yeah.
I'm curious. I like to know these things.
There's a lot.
That's a good answer.
Okay, waste discharge requirements. We heard from Jennifer yesterday, so I don't think I need to repeat a lot of what she said. I will point out that the programs that have state board targets that Ryan mentioned will have the little box. So I don't know if Jennifer mentioned this yesterday, but our targets this year include 25 inspections and one individual permit to be adopted. And this year's program priorities are grouped into three main categories: permitting activities. Yesterday, Jennifer talked about the general fund or general permit enrollments, wineries, etc. Funding, compliance oversight and enforcement, and program efficiencies and improvements, geotracker templates, those sorts of things. Any questions about that one? Okay, NPDES, Hold on a second. No, I forgot to say, I'm going to try to mention the number of staff in each of these programs. So with Jennifer's program, she has 6 engineers and geologists, 2 students. Okay, this is Arwen's program. Get my notes here. She has 3 engineers and geologists and 2 students that work in this program. Targets include 2 minor permit renewals, 4 major permit renewals, 3 minor inspections, and 10 major inspections. If you recall from Arwen's report, the last board meeting, a minor permit is one that serves, or a treatment plant that's less than 1 million gallons per day. Major is greater than 1 million gallons per day. These numbers are set by EPA. We don't have any discretion with setting these numbers. We have not done a good job. I shouldn't word it that way. We have not met our targets in the last couple years because of the resources that we have. It's unlikely that we'll meet the renewal targets. We do meet our inspection targets, but not our renewal targets. We have a couple major projects coming up that may sideline a lot of the other work that we're going to do. And you'll hear more about Cal-Am, DSAL, Diablo Canyon as we move forward.
So, Harvey, if we are unable to meet our targets and they're set by US EPA, what's the discussion that we have with them?
So, maybe Tay or Ryan want to talk about it, but we do get asked each year by State Board Exec and EPA about these targets, and we have to explain why we didn't meet them.
I think it's important from a perspective to tell you also that most other regions don't meet their targets either. It's based on the amount of funding, and some of that funding goes to State Board, and then the rest goes to the Regional Board. And the other issue is our workforce is not experienced anymore. And these permits require very technical expertise. It takes years to grow because all of these have such unique things involved in them that needs analysis. And so most regions are in the same boat where the number of staff are just not enough in order to meet these targets that EPA sets.
And thank you for that.
We get a talking to at MCC, DMC usually.
Right, but does US EPA have any rebuttal to that and any sort of funding? And is there any visioning of revising those targets? Or, you know, have they been revised upward or downward in your experience?
Not really, but I engage with them, explain the situation. They're very, you know, understanding, and we just have to try to continue to improve. And but they're good partners in this, and we've really engaged with their teams to see if we can get coaching from some of their technical experts, additional funding to do contractors, but their hands are a little bit tied as well with their funding. So it's a continual conversation, and they understand, and we're transparent with them about what our abilities are. And so there's a second one. This is the list that we can achieve versus the ones that they tell us we have to achieve.
And so to your point about mentoring and transfer of knowledge, is there any sort of State Board, EPA program that provides training and support and any sort of mentoring or transfer of knowledge? Because certainly workforce is always changing, and it's important to ensure that there's contingency planning and consistency throughout these processes.
Mm-hmm. There's some good training, MPDS permit writing, but you sit in a class for a few days, it's really about doing it and working through the data with the discharger. And then who knows what type of public outreach we have to do. And that's another thing. We've really increased our efforts in public outreach with tribes and all impacted communities that may be potentially impacted by the discharge. So there's just... it's unknown sometimes what you're going to deal with, and And sometimes a class can't really tell you how to do that.
It's learning by doing. I mean, Yes. That's really it. Yeah. And but I do appreciate that there's community dialogue and discussion, and I think that that is extremely important. It's just as important as the language of the NPDES permit is that engagement and education for community as well. Mm-hmm. So I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Yes, Dr. Wolf.
Well, first, I appreciate the fact that you quit Cal Poly, learn by doing. But moving along, I see smiling faces back there. I would assume that EPA does not set those targets in a vacuum. They probably, you know, look at, you know, how many permits we have. I mean, there must be some mechanism that is used to establish those targets. So can you expand on that a little bit?
Sure. The underlying target, you're right, there is more to it, is EPA would like to see that we have 80% of our permits renewed by the time they expire every 5 years. So if we were to successfully renew 6 permits this year, we'd be on track to meeting that 80% goal.
You mentioned that there might be these two major permit efforts. Is that going to happen in the FY 2024-2025?
We're not certain the timing of adoption, but work will definitely happen this year. PG&E would like to get their permit. They've told us their plan. They're expecting their Nuclear Regulatory Commission, their federal license, in mid to late summer 2025. They would like our NPDES permit in a similar timing. A complication for this one is that federal license will require that we also issue a 401 certification, which is a totally different type of 401 certification than Phil was talking about yesterday.
And when was that last certification? 1990
probably.
Yeah.
Yeah. So even if we aren't able to bring it to the board next July, this fiscal year, we will be doing significant work and it will take significant resources. And the other one is the CalAm desal permit. They have similar timing expectations. They would like a permit from us. It will be a modification of the Monterey 1 water discharge permit. They'll be using the same outfall. So it won't be a new permit, won't even count as a renewed permit because that permit is not expired, but it will require significant modification of the permit.
So back on the Diablo Canyon, you said it requires a 401. They would need that.
They would need that before July? Is that what you're saying?
They want it in the same time frame as their NRC permit, which is what they're planning on August to get that license from the federal government.
Okay. It's not very far away.
No.
It's also a very complex permit, Mr. Yes. Lodge.
Yeah, and Harvey brings up an important point with our fiscal year. That's, I don't want to say it's arbitrary, but when it comes to water quality and the projects that we're working on, you can get 95% of the work done in one fiscal year. The permit gets adopted in the next fiscal year, and somehow it's the next fiscal year where the work is captured. So that's something we have to take into consideration also when we're talking about our program priorities for a fiscal year. It's good to have these targets and to have those, but oftentimes it doesn't overlap with the reality of what we're working on.
And you're in communications, obviously, with PG&E. This is, you know, an ongoing discussion that has happened over decades. So,
Very frequent communication with both PG&E and CalAm.
Right. Hi, Ms. Arwin.
Hi. Arwin Wyatt, Mayor, NPDES Program Manager. I just want to speak to some of this a little bit. So Harvey has mentioned PG&E's preference, their request that we have their NPDES permit and 401 cert by next late summer, August-ish, 2025. There are other factors that we're going to need to consider. Not only is this a particularly complicated and controversial type of permit, but also I'll note that EPA has made a recommendation, and this is as part of the NRC's supplemental environmental impact study process. EPA has recommended that PG&E work with us to perform a new impingement and entrainment study, and you'll learn all about that later. But I've been reaching out to EPA trying to talk to the right people, haven't had the conversations yet to understand how strongly they feel about this, because if we were to require that study, it would take a year. It takes a year to perform these types of studies. And so there are other moving pieces that we need to consider. Additionally, looking at how long it typically takes us to write regular permits, not nuclear ones through cooling permits. My estimate is that it would take us probably about 2 years to really do this permit fully, correctly, all of that. And that's because it's a complex permit, a complex situation, a lot of years of data and all of that. So I just want to point those things out. There's what PG&E would like us to do. We would love to be able to do that, but there are other factors that we are considering and need to consider.
Thank you very much, Dr. Hunter.
Yes, when you're describing the components of the permit, would that also include mitigation?
My understanding is that mitigation has been largely settled through, so they have their once through cooling related mitigation, and they pay every year related to that, and they have the thermal effects, and there was a big lawsuit and all of that,
yeah.
And so they've paid for mitigation related to that. If we do a new entrainment and impingement study, it's possible that could affect mitigation potentially. We don't really know. That's one of the things we want to talk about with EPA in terms of why they're recommending this. And then other agencies I know are considering forms of mitigation as well, like Coastal Commission is looking at
right.
other forms of mitigation as well.
Yeah, I recall when we looked at it prior, there was a very elaborate plan for fisheries. Do you know if that is still part of the overall design?
I don't know all the details at this point. We're just in the kind of beginning stages of this and reading a very long record
yeah.
lately related to this,
yeah.
trying to understand all the moving pieces, all this lengthy history, a lot of battles that I'm sure you
yeah.
are aware of, a lot of them.
Yeah, so, yeah. Okay, well, I'll be interested to see the mitigation.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you.
Dr. Wolf.
Yes, so thank you. As we talk about the permits, and specifically the 413 was mentioned, but my understanding, we have some other permits involved with the facility. Some that come to mind is the desal plant. Some that come to mind is on-site water treatment system. Some that comes to mind is the stormwater industrial permit. And that's just skimming the surface. So we basically have several permits that we're going to have to address, right, concurrently.
Yeah,
and some of them may have different timing requirements based on other permits which are outside of our swim lane. So how does that work?
Yeah, many of these waste streams are already included in the permit. That's part of why it's a very complex permit. They have an awful lot of discharge points
exactly.
listed in their permit. So that does increase the complexity and all of that. And then for the stormwater piece, like other permits and other programs, those, I don't know that they'll contribute really to the timeline, like the stormwater industrial permit, if that needs to be modified. There are a lot of other agencies certainly involved in this project, and they're going to need to be going through all of their actions as well. And we're going to be coordinating closely, because, for example, if we're doing another impingement and entrainment study, they're going to be very interested in those results. So, yeah, it's a complex project
right.
for sure.
Yeah, so all I was trying to do, and particularly more for not for us, a thing in our group. We're pretty aware of all these, but any member of the public listening is that it goes well beyond the 401 cert, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
That's a good point. I mean, there's Coastal Commission, there's State Lands Commission, there's Department of Water Resources, Natural Resources, there's us, there's a whole host of considerations and agencies at the NRC at the table. And so it is, we can only focus, obviously, on the discrete nature of our permits, but we will be working with a lot of partners and certainly the community as well.
Just quick, is PUC also involved?
I don't think the PUC.
I'm sorry, Public Utilities Commission. Sorry. Are they involved?
I don't know that they're involved in the Diablo project specifically. They haven't been mentioned in any of the calls that we've had so far. They're involved in the Cal-Am desal project, but not, I don't know that they're involved in Diablo at this point.
Yeah, they haven't been at any meetings. Anybody else want to?
Yeah, I don't believe they're involved. They are going to be involved in the Cal-Am project, but I don't know that for the Diablo project.
Well, they are involved in the larger Diablo issues and finding of reliability need, but I think they've already made that finding.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, Arwen.
Thanks, Arwen. Okay, Mary. Wastewater consolidation. Arwen is also the program manager here. It consists of two engineers. The core goal here is to provide relief to disadvantaged communities through sewering failing septic system areas or smaller wastewater systems that could use assistance by consolidating with larger systems. And this slide lists a few of the top projects we're working on, four of them. Just important to remember that these are very long-term projects, longer term than I think we expected when we started this program, but it takes a lot of coordination with a lot of agencies to get these projects across the finish line. Any questions on this one?
No, but yes, it's a lot of coordination. I would echo that. Dr. Hunter.
Yes, and where does grant management fall? Do we have a role if the State Water Board gives them a revolving fund loan? Or?
Yes, we deal with the State Board's Division of Financial Assistance a lot with this program. When the program was set up a few years ago, there was expected to be a lot of grant money available. And we made a lot of promises to these communities that we would be providing a lot of assistance, financial assistance. It's kind of been pulled back a little bit, which has, again, slowed things down. But, it's hard. You know, getting Bolsa Knolls into the Salinas system is not going to be possible without significant funding sources, for instance.
And once the funding is in place, do we have a role in oversight of those grants, or it's all State Board?
That would be State Board primarily, yeah. If there are technical advisory committees, we would probably have a role in that, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. And one last question. When State Board is the primary regarding funding management, once a grant is issued, do they look at it on a regional basis, or is it individual facility management? How do they address that?
It's project-specific management.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. We have another question. Dr. Wolf.
And this is more terminology. You know, I retrained myself years ago to use the word on-site water treatment system.
Mm-hmm,
that
mm-hmm.
was all your fault. And now I see EPA septic systems. So does EPA use a different terminology than the Water Board?
That's a good question. I don't think EPA uses OWTS like State Board did with their policy. I think septic systems is a fine, useful term for just shorthand for OTS.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just curious. Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Board Member Harlan.
Good morning. Could you, Harvey, briefly tell us what the big problem is with each of these projects?
Yeah, maybe I can try. Hacienda is a small, a privately owned apartment complex just outside Soledad city limits.
Between the state prison and the 101.
Yes, yes. They have a septic system that's not in the best condition. It's a disadvantaged community. We would really like to get them hooked into the Soledad sewer system. We're working with both Monterey County and the city and trying to get one of them to step forward and take the project on, be the grant recipient, do the work, get the project done. As far as the biggest hang up there, I think it's getting one of the city or the county to step forward. We try to do this voluntarily. The law does have some provisions for forcing it, but we've never tried that. I don't think it's happened in the state yet. We'd prefer not to do it that way.
I think it's also fair to say that that's substandard housing as well. So it's a pretty comp, and they have water issues. They have nitrate in their wells. Yeah. The housing is from the 1950s. They're army barracks from the 1950s. They're not sprinkled. It's really not a habitable location.
Yeah, that definitely is an issue in the whole part of it also.
And we are working with the parties to try to get this to move forward in a voluntary manner. The best thing, I think, for everyone would get this apartment complex connected to the sewer system, which is relatively close to the location of the housing right now. But it's taken some time to do that, and it's an ongoing process.
I think the turnout is right across the street, the wastewater yes. turnout. So it's really...
It's close.
It's very yeah. close.
Bolson Knolls is a larger project. It's a good-sized neighborhood just outside of Salinas city limits. That one, we're moving slowly. It's going to take a lot of community outreach. The community, I don't think, you know, I'm pretty sure you could say it's whether the citizens want to get rid of their septic systems and move to a sewer. Depends on what the, you know, the situation is for each individual homeowner there. Again, it's going to take a significant amount of funding to get that done. It's quite a few houses that would require hookups. But I think we are making good progress. We have a local technical assistance provider that we're coordinating with and helping to do community outreach with. The last two, I'd say the main issue is funding. Santa Cruz County has a services area up in the Boulder Creek area. They have a plan to expand that services area to the town of Boulder Creek and some other outlying areas. We would really love to see this go forward. These towns are right on Boulder Creek and other sensitive waterways, all on septic systems. But funding here is the major hang-up. And Chular... they have serious issues with their wastewater treatment facility. We would love to see this one hooked up to Monterey One's facility. It would require the connection to go through the city of Salinas, but would end up at Monterey One.
A quick question for you, Harvey. On Bolson Knolls, who will be doing the community outreach? Will it be the city of Salinas, Monterey County, and or us?
All three. All three. Yes, mm-hmm, definitely. And we're involved working with the county supervisor. That office has been really good to work with on this.
Thank you.
So since we're talking about funding, so let's say they all get hooked up, right, to a facility. What does that do to their costs
exactly.
per month?
Exactly. So the funding that State Board has promised would include the lateral construction, which is big, but then you're faced with the ongoing cost of getting you know, the collection system and the treatment, which would be a new cost. It would replace one-time capital improvement cost to have your tank replaced, your leach field replaced, but it's a totally new way of a totally new cost for the homeowners, definitely.
And I would hazard to guess that most of these are disadvantaged communities, right? So
yes.
That new cost would be potentially somewhat prohibitive. Is that correct?
Could be, definitely. Yeah.
Okay. Yes, Dr. Wolf.
But isn't that always the case, though, is with grants, O&M operation and maintenance is not included?
Exactly.
Generally, so.
Yeah. Recall Jennifer's last update on Big Basin wastewater system. That subdivision agreed to tax themselves a very high amount to get the ongoing treatment and collection system operating. And they had to agree to do it. Yeah.
And I think that's just at the crux of my question is these should be voluntary. But when we're talking to communities who are underrepresented and certainly under the MHI, it becomes another consideration for that community to opt into something voluntarily, right? Because it's a cost that they can't potentially bear. So it becomes a complicated situation. Very, very quickly. I'm sorry, median household income. Thank you, Dr. Hunter.
Okay, we'll move to recycled water. This is a new entry in the strategic plan. Last year's version didn't include this. State board.
I lied, Harvey. I have another question that
sure.
I knew was knocking around in my head. So all of these, the state board is going through their wastewater needs assessment process. And so I would imagine that all of these systems, potentially with the host of other systems, are included in the Central Coast for wastewater needs assessment. Is that accurate?
That, yes, is accurate. But I mean, look at Bolsa Knolls, for instance. It's going to look at the city of Salinas' collection system. Well, not even that. They're only looking at treatment plants, which is Monterey 1. High-class, first-rate treatment mm-hmm. system. What about Bolsa Knolls?
Right.
It's not going to be included because it's not actually serviced yet.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Recycled water. Brand-new program. We're calling it a brand new program. We've been doing a lot of work on recycled water, but we recently received funding for specific positions to work in recycled water. So we have two new positions. They have not yet been filled. So a big priority is getting those positions filled and up to speed and trained. The goal of this program is going to be taking workload off the other permitting programs and coordinating our recycling efforts office-wide. Dr. Wolf had a good question yesterday about groundwater recharge, for instance, and this unit would be taking that on. I think it's even bigger than just calling it groundwater recharge. There's another term that's used called managed aquifer recharge, which in itself can be very big definition. It can go all the way from, you know, releases from reservoirs to on-site stormwater recharge. But we hope to use this program to look at how to improve that coordination, that permitting, and increase water supply resiliency for communities. Any questions on that one?
So
I have one.
Okay. Yes. So yes, Board Member Hoskins and then Board Member Harlan.
Sure. So you mentioned here Pierwater Monterey expansion, Morro Bay and Carpinteria.
Mm-hmm.
What is the Morro Bay and Carpinteria references or a particular project there this year?
Yes, those are projects in development. Moving along pretty well. Carpinteria is working with, it's a joint project between Carpinteria Water District and Carpinteria Sanitary District. They are going to take wastewater treated at their wastewater plant there, reinject it into the aquifer. Morro Bay, virtually the same type of situation.
But I'd like to point out that Carpinteria had state board funding, but unfortunately lost about $10 million due to the budget. So that project was impacted severely this past year they were moving along at a pretty good clip. And yes, Tamara, I see your face. yeah, that because this money is all leveraged, right? You leverage your state funding from your federal funding, and so it becomes a game of dominoes, and it has really impacted the
with the system in South San Luis Obispo County. Yeah, they lost some funding.
So it, I mean, these budget cuts not only impact us, but these projects that we're funding, and so it slows down our ability to make progress.
Did I mention that Leah is the program manager? So one of her programs. Yeah.
Lemoyne.
Yeah.
Any more questions, Ms. Hoskins? Okay. Ms. Harlan.
I think next is...
Ms. Harlan has a question.
Oh, sorry.
Thank you. That was my question also. Thank you very much.
Okay. Angela.
Good morning, Angela Schroeder, a supervising engineering geologist, and the groundwater protection and regional monitoring programs are within my section. Before I get into the programs in my section, maybe I'll talk a little bit about how staff and program managers use this tool, this program priorities tool. So we've all been talking about sort of in the context of the overall organization and how it's important to manage resources. On a day-to-day basis, we do as you might guess, a multitude of tasks, so many projects and priorities. We're also obviously a public-facing agency, so public service and responding to public inquiries are also important. And Taya Tryon and Ryan Lodge have been very supportive of making sure that we have good workload management, managing our resources, and proper work-life balance. So on a day-to-day basis, it's very important for us to work with our staff to focus on the priorities. Right, and so we are using this tool on a daily basis to assess, does this, what we're working on today, match with the priorities that you're seeing here? And so just wanted to sort of emphasize using this program priorities document strategic plan as a tool to help us manage our workload.
I appreciate that because, you have to juggle a lot of competing demands and certainly manage your own stress level and everybody else's stress level and ensure that you're providing proper guidance as you move forward. So I appreciate that there's potentially some tool that can help you move through that.
Right. And so as Harvey was discussing the bullets on the slide, I was like, whoa, this is like a tiny bit, right, of what his program staff face every day. So with that, I'll get into the site cleanup program. And that program is managed by senior engineering geologist Greg Bishop. And one of the common themes you'll see on these slides is that one of our highest priorities right now is to really focus on recruitment and retention of qualified, well-trained staff. So the highest priority for the site cleanup program is to protect human health and the environment by reducing risk through investigation and cleanup. It's one of our traditional programs here at the Water Board. Typical cleanup sites include dry cleaners, industrial and manufacturing facilities, and the program also addresses soil vapors that may impact human health through indoor air. So currently, we have 143 cleanup sites that are actively managed in our region, and again, under the direction of senior engineering geologist Greg Bishop. The site cleanup program currently consists of 6.3 technical staff, and then you met Sierra Greninger, who's our scientific aide who helps our section. We also have one vacancy. So in terms of the budget impacts this year, we have not been able to fill that vacancy. So we're running lean in that program. To effectively manage workload, higher risk sites are given higher priority in terms of staff resources, and then that's what you see here on the slide. So again, recruitment and retention of qualified, well-trained staff is one of our highest priorities. You know our work on the airport. It's a very complex site, and we have Dean Thomas helping us on that site. We don't have 16 Thomases, right? So it's really important for us to focus on training our staff and transfer of knowledge. So the second bullet there, one of our highest priorities is to advance the replacement water due to the per- and polyfluoroalkyl alcohol substances, or PFAS, impacts at the SLO Regional Airport. We're advancing PFAS investigations at our other regional airports as well. The first priority, of course, is San Luis Obispo and Santa Barbara. We're also continuing to oversee the trichloroethylene cleanup and abatement activities at Buckley Road. We are also investigating some new sites, which are including investigating 1, 2, 3 trichloropropylene propane impacts to supply wells near Salinas, investigating PFAS impacts to supply wells in Gilroy, and investigating perchlorate impacts to supply wells in Solvang. Those are all drinking water well impacts that are among our highest priorities. We also will continue to work on some existing high priority sites, including Dutch Made Cleaners in Santa Barbara, Scotts Valley Dry Cleaners in Scotts Valley, and Fairway Cleaners in Santa Cruz, all of which have perchloroethylene impacts. We will also continue our work on the former Stemco site in Santa Maria to address TCE and other chemicals in groundwater. Our performance targets for this program from State Board are to move 4 sites into active remediation, so that's from investigation to active remediation, and then to close 6 sites. And that is our site cleanup program.
Thank you. Any questions or comments? Okay, Dr. Wolf.
So, thank you. You know, so we do have some common contaminants, which is the PFAS and the TCE and the TCP. Is there any synergy we can gain from dealing with same constituents and what some of the, you know, cleanup technologies would be? And I'm looking at it from two aspects. What type of technology is recommended? You know, are we talking about a point of entry, point of use? Also, many of these locations, we're going to look at different consultants. And I'm thinking out loud, you know, every time you have a consultant, start from ground zero, and then we move on. But is there any type of portability of saying, hey, you don't need to reinvent the wheel? This is how it has been done in these other sites. I'm just thinking about the efficiency that can be gained and from the lessons learned.
I'll chime on then on those questions. I'm Greg Bishop, the program manager for the site cleanup program. I heard a couple of different questions there about synergy. You specifically asked about point of entry or point of use, and that's more specific to the, we call it water replacement, it's really filtration. In that context, I think there's a fair bit of portability for a point of use or point of entry type treatment, in that filtration is filtration. There's some differences. You want different filter media for different contaminants, and there's sizing issues about how much water is going to be pushed through and so forth. But there are a lot of similarities in those systems across different pollutants. That's a fairly uncommon need, however, in our cleanup program. We have only a couple of sites right now that have water replacement going on. That's the Olin site with perchlorate, which has had treatment going on for a couple of decades now and has been successful. You heard about it at a recent board meeting in Gilroy. It's had some success in seeing the plume shrink and so forth, so that demand is less. The new one, and I'm pleased to say it's in a good place right now, is the San Luis Obispo County Airport for PFAS. But a lot of the same techniques were applied in that, and that's been built. You can hear more about it next month, but that's been built out to have treatment applied, point of entry treatment to over 50 affected supply wells just on the other side of the airport here in San Luis Obispo. In terms of treatment options for pollutants outside the drinking water context, there's some portability, but pollutants vary. Some have volatility and lend themselves to techniques like vapor extraction. Some are more susceptible to being treated by, say, an oxidant. Some are more susceptible to being treated by bioremediation. The PFAS compounds, which I'm thinking of as our growth sector in site cleanup, unfortunately don't really have cleanup options right now, other than to contain them, which isn't really a cleanup option, or maybe put in a permeable barrier to prevent it spreading, but that's still not really destroying it or removing it necessarily. And so we're keeping tabs on technology as they evolve on that, and perhaps someday some of the existing techniques can be applied there, but we're not there yet. One of the things, I'll just close with this about site cleanup, is there are no two sites that are the same. There's lots of different conditions, the pollutant types, the media in the ground, is it permeable or not? And the receptors that are vary tremendously by site. So it's very much a site-specific decision for remediation.
So taking advantage of, you know, your obvious in-depth knowledge on this topic, do we have any assistance at the state board level of utilizing some of their technical resource? Because we're not our own little island. Unfortunately, these constituents find themselves in other part of the state as well.
We have different resources available from state board and other state agencies even for technical expertise. We don't have a formal relationship necessarily to have state board staff work on our projects, but I will routinely contact, there's Wendy Link you heard from when we did a PFAS update a year or so back, for example, is a PFAS technical specialist at state board, and we're in constant contact and they're always happy to help on that. More formally, which we're about to, what we've already begun to engage on, is related to San Luis Obispo County Airport. We have contracting options available to have toxicologists at OEA, the Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment, assist us. So we have good relationships with different agencies, and when we need to draw on some of their expertise, I found them to be readily available.
And while you're here, I would just, you know, say thank you, you and Dean. I don't see Dean here, but for all the extraordinary work that you have done with the San Luis Obispo County Airport, and that is moving along in no small measure because of you and Dean and your dedication, both, you know, day-to-day at the meetings, and I really very much appreciate it. I'm sure my colleagues do, because it's a complex project. It was prickly at the very beginning, and I think we're in a really good place now, and just want to appreciate you both for that.
I agree, we're in a good place. I'll add, we're going to hear more about that at the next board meeting.
Yes, I know, but you're standing here, so
kudos. And it's where it is because of your support, too, so thank you.
Yeah. But, you know, supplementing, you know, Chair Gray's kudos to you, well-deserved, and your team. You know, I've witnessed this myself at some of the meetings that I attended. I think one thing that always has impressed me, in addition to, you know, your technical contribution to address the site cleanup, is the engagement, the very close engagement with the community. I think that's a very important element, because quite often, you know, we can look at things from an internal perspective. Oh, we got to clean up, so we're going to do X, Y, Z. But sometimes, unfortunately, you know, the folks who are directly impacted are sort of on the sideline. It's like, hey, you know, what's going on? Where here, there's a significant amount of efforts, you know, of you have regular meetings that are posted, scheduled, they're available online. People can actually, you know, participate remotely. So to me, that's it's very impressive to see, you know, that part, which takes a significant additional amount of effort, because those meetings are not held during the day. Those meetings are held in the evening. So you're here, or at, you know, at Farnborough, you know, attending the meetings after hours. So that's very impressive to me.
Well, thank you. I think that's been a big part of getting us to the point we're at now, too, is keeping the community informed, and also us reacting to some of the feedback they give us about their needs and wants.
I just wanted to ask a question about the dry cleaners, since we have three of them on here. Are these old cleanup problems or recent ones? And is this something systematic that, you know, dry cleaners are going to continue to be an issue with the PCE?
Well, the PCE has been phased out, so we're not necessarily seeing new discharges from that per se. That's not to say there aren't new dry cleaner sites with PCE impacts being discovered. To answer your question, two of the three here are relatively old ones, meaning decades old. The Dutch Maid and Scotts Valley dry cleaners sites. The Fairway cleaners site came to our attention probably 3-4 years back, and had a lot of investigation going on. Unfortunately, as is common with dry cleaners, the operators often don't have a lot of funds, or they may not be around anymore given the discharges happened decades back. And at Fairway, for example, we're running into some funding issues. The RP there, the responsible party there, spent their life savings to get us to the point they're at with investigation. That's been exhausted now, but they don't qualify for grants. And there's a different story for every site. I mentioned they're all unique from a technical angle. They're also very different, often from a responsible party's perspective of cooperation and willingness and ability to pay and so forth. And many of the dry cleaner sites sit on the books for years because there's no real funding there to get them ahead. So anyway, most of the dry cleaners are older. We do still get new ones trickling in. We know there's a lot of them out there that have not been investigated, and that's likely to continue with that new case emerging. That said, we're not seeing nearly as many dry cleaners in recent years as we are with the PFAS emerging.
Yeah, no, that sounds actually positive that PCE has been phased out. That's been through another environmental regulation or...
Well, for dry cleaners, I don't recall the exact timing, but it's been phased out for quite some time now.
Thank you, Mr. Bishop.
All right, thank you.
So the next program I'll discuss is the Department of the Defense Program. This program is managed by Senior Engineering Geologist Amber Selinger, and the highest priority here is to support the federal government's efforts to reduce risks and clean up waste on DOD facilities so that future land uses will be protective of public health and the environment. Currently, the DOD program oversees hundreds of sites on six major military facilities here on the Central Coast. In this program, we currently have 2.9 technical staff. I also want to mention that we recently acquired a paid intern from State Board. We were offered the opportunity to apply for a paid intern, and we were able to receive that resource here. The intern that we have is actually Jose Lozano, who used to work for the Irrigated Lands Program. And the focus of his work will be actually on helping us to assess the water quality impacts related to rocket launch activities. So it's sort of a new emerging area for our DOD program. So in terms of our priorities for 24-25, again, the recruitment and retention of qualified, well-trained staff. We are advancing remediation and investigation at high priority sites at former Fort Ord, Vandenberg Space Force Base, Camp Roberts, and also the former Lompoc U.S. Army Disciplinary Barracks. We are also evaluating the DOD process for identifying impacts to water supply wells and public notification. This is something that we routinely do at site cleanup, is working with the public, as you just discussed, in terms of understanding the impacts to their drinking water wells. You can imagine that the DOD process for that is not the same as what we do for other sites, and so we are looking more closely at their process to making sure we have the same high level of community engagement. We are also evaluating potential impacts to groundwater quality from historical and current DOD land use practices. Again, an example of that is the rocket launch activities at Vandenberg. And also, we are evaluating PFAS investigation reports for former Fort Ord, Fort Hunter Liggett, Vandenberg Space Force Base, Camp San Luis Obispo, and Camp Roberts. And we don't have any State Board-directed performance targets for the DOD program.
I just have a question on Vandenberg, and I haven't been really working with them my private life for a long time, but I do know that they were initially involved in the GSA formation out there on the San Antonio Creek Basin, GSA. So they had been a little bit more transparent. You have Amber. How is that relationship?
You know what? Being new out on Vandenberg, I don't have knowledge of the relationship.
Okay.
So I can't speak to that.
Okay.
I don't know.
Thanks.
Angela, yeah.
Yeah, we could certainly follow up.
Yeah. I mean, they had been collaborative in that process, mm-hmm. So good sign. But that was a while ago.
Yeah.
Yes, Dr. Wolf.
So it's probably, the answer might be, well, Jean-Pierre, it's all over the place. But when we're looking at all these different locations, how old... are those facilities, we're looking at things that took place 25 years ago, 50 years ago, or it's just very significantly, you know, I'm look at Vandenberg Space Force. I'm looking at the unhappy place, U.S. Army Disciplinary Barracks, you know, so, and is there a range?
I'd say these are long-term projects. I mean, they're old releases that we continue to monitor and oversee the cleanup. It just takes a long time. So, yeah, for the most part, they are long-term, 50, 60-year-old groundwater impacts that we're looking at.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. And also just to follow up, Amber works really closely with the Department of Defense. You know, it's all, just like our state funding, right? The federal funding is also meticulously looked. And so they do long-range work planning efforts to look at how we're going to investigate and remediate these sites that have been existing for decades.
Good morning. Quick question for you regarding Vandenberg Air Force Base. Last week, the Coastal Commission denied an increase to 50 launches per year by SpaceX. And I read in the media the week before that they're looking to actually go up to 100 launches per year. And I realize it was a non-binding vote by the Coastal Commission, but are we coordinating with the Coastal Commission and as well as other agencies and Vandenberg to look at these impacts of going to 50 and possibly 100 launches?
Yeah, I'll just say generally and then let Amber talk more specifically. But in general, we do work closely with the Coastal Commission. You know, our perspective is from the impact, potential impacts to water quality. So as an example, we're coordinating with Coastal Commission and other agencies with respect to their draft environmental assessment related to the increase in the cadence of the launches. So we're providing comments in that way, and we'll be evaluating that data to assess the potential impact. Anything to add there, Amber?
Oh, I think you covered it. I mean, we just issued a letter on the draft environmental assessment for the increase in rocket launches at Space Launch Complex 4, which that one's going from 36 to 50 launches per year. So we issued comments, and we are reviewing the potential impacts to water quality from those activities. So our letter covers that they need to provide us more information, clarifications, and that we are going to plan to work with them to possibly require additional conditions. And we're certainly following the Coastal Commission and what they're doing as well on this. So, and also to clarify, they are planning to submit another draft environmental assessment for that increase to 100, which is at a different space launch complex, 6. So we're anticipating that to come in as well, and we'll be looking at that.
Thank you.
Great. So let's move on to the underground storage tank program. This program is also managed by senior engineering geologist Greg Bishop. This is one of our longstanding environmental regulatory programs. We've actually been working with UST program sites since 1983, and there's very specific and prescriptive federal and state laws and regulations. One of the ways we implement the program is to use the UST program's low threat policy, which is sort of a streamlined process that really helps us to gain efficiency in this program. So currently, in this program, we have 28 underground storage tank sites actively managed in the Central Coast region. The UST program currently consists of one technical staff, and due to the current budget reductions, the UST program did lose a half of one position, which is shared with the site cleanup program. So, and that loss is really because it was vacant at the time of the reduction. So for fiscal year 24-25, our UST program priorities include, again, trying to staff back up and train our new staff, working with the state board to implement the stalled cases initiative, which is to gain progress on some of the sites that have not had significant movement. And then we're also evaluating new cases as some of the remaining single-walled underground storage tanks are upgraded. We do have state board performance targets for this program, and that is to move sites from investigation to active remediation. We have the goal of one site and also to close five cases. And I should have mentioned that the site cleanup program and the UST program case closure targets are reported in our executive officer's report, so you see those every board meeting. Questions? Next program is our land disposal program. This program is managed by Senior Water Resources Control Engineer Joey Sisk. And the board actually heard a lot about this program during the update at the last board meeting. Currently, there are approximately 56 land disposal facilities actively managed here in our region. And the land disposal program currently consists of 2.3 technical staff. For fiscal year 24-25, again, recruiting and retaining our qualified staff. We're also developing site-specific monitoring and reporting programs and enrolling closed landfill facilities for the recently adopted closed landfill order from the August board meeting. We're also reviewing PFAS data for landfills and evaluating priority sites for follow-up. And we're also reviewing a joint technical document update for the Tahigas landfill. One of our priorities consistently is to conduct construction oversight, and that's especially related to new modules, new final covers, et cetera, and we're doing that in 24-25 at the City of Watsonville Landfill, Santa Maria Regional Landfill Module Extension Project, the Casmalia Liner Project, the Monterey Peninsula Landfill Module Extension, the Cold Canyon Landfill Liner Project, and Z-Best Compost Pond and Site Upgrade Project. And then finally, we are also always trying to review our wet weather preparedness. As we know, we're having increasing storm activities at our landfills and our composting facilities, and so we're working with them to do the wet weather preparedness and to conduct inspections to verify implementation. We have state board performance targets, and that's to conduct at least 60 annual inspections in our land disposal program. Any questions?
Yeah, so with the increased emphasis on diverting waste through various recycling means, you know, green waste, composting, plastics, papers, etc., the traditional landfills, the landscape looks totally different today. They're becoming almost on-site recycling facility to some extent. So because of the complexity associated with some of these other activities beyond the, you know, location where we actually eventually rest the materials, you see an increasing amount of staff efforts, requirements in order to address all those issues. You know, we've visited landfill, when was it, last year?
Tahigas was 2 years ago.
Or 2 years ago. I mean, that's, to me, a very good example where, you know, you also now have, you know, biodigester generation facilities. So could you comment a little bit on the, perhaps the added complexity associated with landfills as a whole?
Yeah, I'll comment generally and then ask Joey Sis to come and address if he has any more specifics. I will say that it is complex technically, you know, so our staff are having to go and to learn a variety of technical issues about composting, the surface impoundments, right, the how we are working with the different sort of diversion activities. In addition, I think there's increased complexity with just the program management and administration, right? So there could be several contractors, subcontractors. You have the county, you have private entities that are managing different parts of the landfill. And so who's responsible for what and when and how that all occurs does create some logistical complexities as well. And I'll let Joey add to that.
Yeah, I think Angela addressed that pretty well. I don't have a whole lot to add other than, yeah, in general, the complexity does increase, and it adds to the workload to have additional facilities that are sometimes separately permitted as composting facilities that we have to permit and regulate as well.
Okay, last in my section for this part of the program is the Active Welfare Program, and I'll just let Joey stand there. So he also manages the Active Oil Fields Program, and in general, the Active Oil Fields Program regulates oil field activities that have the potential to impact surface water or groundwater quality, especially underground sources of drinking water. And we do this in close coordination with the California Geologic Energy Management Division, or CalGEM, and also US EPA. In addition, our Active Oil Fields Program also manages a beneficial reuse order for petroleum-impacted soils, which are produced at our active oil landfills. Active oil fields. Currently, there are approximately 22 active oil fields in the Central Coast region, and the Active Oil Fields Program currently consists of 5 technical staff. This is also a program where we're trying to recruit and retain our well-trained staff. Our priorities for 24-25 are the Cat Canyon Aquifer Exemption to review and approve the conduit remediation and monitoring plans, the Cat Canyon Resources Cyclic Steam Underground Injection Control Project, and that's to evaluate area of review submittals for our cyclic steam wells. Also at the ERA Energy Water Disposal Project at the San Ardo oil field is to review our underground injection control projects at that site, including potential release of produced water to groundwater. We're also coordinating with CalGEM to implement Senate Bill 1137, and that prohibits the issuance of well permits and new production facilities within specific zones. Our staff is also working to address active and historic produced water ponds. In addition, we're supporting CalGEM and local agencies to oversee well abandonment, facility decommissioning, and lease restoration on former oil field leases. And I'll just mention this one specifically in that this is becoming an increased activity as some of our oil fields are looking to change land use practices. And so the act of decommissioning is a new area for us that we're working with local agencies as well as CalGEM. And finally, we are reviewing and providing feedback to CalGEM on new aquifer exemption applications, including associated conduit analyses.
Go ahead, yes.
One quick question. There were a couple of pieces of legislation that were passed and signed by the governor regarding orphaned or abandoned oil well capping. Will we have, do we know yet if we'll have any kind of oversight or involvement in that?
I'll let Joey answer that question.
Yeah, not off the top of my head, no. I don't think we're going to have a significant amount of direct involvement in that. It's usually handled by CalGEM. But there may be some specific cases where CalGEM reaches out to us in a consulting manner to ask for our input.
Thank you.
Yes. This is Ryan Lodge, the executive officer. Sometimes we do advise in some of the surface facilities that have to come into, you know, when they're abandoning some wells. Sometimes there's pipelines and other and tanks at the surface, and we do get involved with the local, oftentimes the county and whatnot, to make sure that those areas are properly cleaned up.
Thank you.
Yes, go ahead, Dr. Hunter.
Thank you. I am wondering about the aquifer exemption status of applications, and do we foresee this as a steady state kind of aspect to this program, or is it expanding? Where do we sit?
I'd say it's a bit of an unknown at this point. It's historically has been, I think, to my knowledge, relatively steady state. But I'd say in general, oil field production is tapering off. A lot of our oil fields are a lot of the more economically available oil has been already pulled from the ground, so to speak. And in general, I'd expect over the decades a tapering of oil production, so which may mean there'd be fewer aquifer exemptions over the long term. Over the short term, I would expect more of a steady state future.
So what's involved in the aquifer exemption process altogether? I mean, is it a specific permit or is it a specific aspect of an existing permit? How do those work?
So these are a little unique, I would say, for the water boards. But in general, it's actually the federal EPA who oversees the aquifer exemptions. The water boards provide our concurrence that we agree that we don't believe it will impact high quality waters and that there won't be impacts to people's drinking water wells, to groundwater, to surface waters. Our role is to kind of review the available data, the information, make sure it's not going to impact water quality.
And then how much of our effort goes into coordinating with Dogger, and I think the name has changed, but Division of Oil.
CalGEM.
Is that CalGEM?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right. So I see it here then represented. How much of our time goes into that?
We spend a lot of time coordinating with CalGEM. There's multiple meetings, standing meetings per month we have with them and with the oil fields section at State Board. Usually we kind of worked collaboratively with State Board and with CalGEM to try to move these aquifer exemptions and really all of our oil and gas work forward.
Mm-hmm. And CalGEM is California...
That's a good, great question. I think I have that in my notes. It's on my head. It's California Geologic Energy Management Division.
Thank you.
Yes, Dr. Wolf.
So a couple of, one is a little factoid for Dr. Hunter, is that the Central Coast Water Board region was the very first region to issue an aquifer exemption when these new regulation came to place, and that goes back to the days of Executive Officer Ken Harris. So we had the very first hearing here. So we were basically somewhat the guinea pigs on this whole new set of requirements, just kind of a little piece of history. To the follow-up of a question from my colleague regarding abandoned wells, one set of wells that I think have been highlighted of having a significant impact is in Santa Barbara County and some of the coastal areas where we still have once in a while some plumes because of some of these very old wells that still in some instance needs to be addressed. And I know we have had time to time, the group with Hillary, Heal the Ocean, thank you very much, would come to our board meetings and kind of show us slides reminding us of, the impact of those wells. So I would think that those would be priority wells versus, in dry land. So to your knowledge, is there any efforts to address those priorities?
If I understand your question, you're referring to offshore wells or
the Carpinteria oil field, right?
Yeah,
those were the
exactly.
First offshore oil fields
in
the world, and
yeah.
It's because of the tar seeps that are there.
Yeah, I know the water boards, to my knowledge, hasn't been involved extensively in the offshore oil wells, but I know there's certainly a priority for California as a whole and a lot of other agencies. California Coastal Commission, I know, has been involved with some of these wells.
State Lands is also
State
really
Lands
involved
Commission,
those wells.
But I'm not actually sure where our jurisdiction falls in actually offshore wells, but it might be a good question for Ryan or Taya.
Yeah, those are handled through the State Lands Commission. And the Active Oil Field Program deals with active oil fields. So ones that are currently drilling, and so we review the projects for, injecting whether it's steam or produced water, and we evaluate those to determine if there's any potential impact on underground sources of drinking water. So that's a primary focus. We do look at well abandonments, but typically that's in active oil field areas to make sure that those wells are abandoned properly, but that's primarily a CalGEM function. But we look at it with the lens of making sure that it's up to the standard so that there won't be an impact or it won't turn into a conduit where fluids from the production zone can get into a drinking water aquifer.
But if these wells, you know, these coastal wells were within 3 miles, you know, which is the area where, as a regional water board, we do have some overlap jurisdiction with the Coastal Commission.
Sure.
What about those?
Yeah, we've talked to the State Lands Commission. It's very technically difficult to deal with wells that are in the intercoastal, you know, in that zone, finding them. What my understanding is that the process of trying to cap a well like that could create a problem. It's very technically difficult to be in the surf zone or right offshore to try to even find the wells. They're very old wells. I don't know that the responsible parties are even around any longer.
They were drilled in like the 1870s and 80s.
Yeah, they're extremely old.
No,
and just the casing, you know, when you start getting into how you would technically drill out, you know, usually they'll drill through the wells to over-drill them and then fill them as part of the capping process. But as you can imagine, the construction of those wells happening, you know, decades ago, it's technically difficult, but we have had conversations with the State Lands Commission and we can touch base with them again. It's a really tough one to.
No, I'm well aware that these are very, very old wells, but it's also still vivid in my memory, you know, some of the drone pictures that, you know, have been presented to us in some of the years ago by, you know, Heal the Ocean as an example. So.
Yeah, and there's also natural seeps that occur in the Santa Barbara Channel in that area. So not all of that material that's coming up is necessarily from a leaking old abandoned well. And so that complicates things as well.
But I do know that State Lands Commission has done dives to identify those locations. You know, I know Heal the Ocean has sought grant funding to go and help support those dives. And we've had a lot of coordination on that side of it. I know that CalGEM is the authority on exploratory wells in our region, but do they notify us about those exploratory wells for oil and gas?
So if you're referring to new wells.
I'm referring to new wells, yeah.
Not necessarily. There's no automatic process that notifies us of wells. Sometimes we are consulted if there's some nexus with our work, but not necessarily.
So once that exploration has happened and there's the desire to drill that, then we get involved. Is that correct? In some sort of an oversight capacity, or is it in an advisory capacity?
We don't have an automatic role necessarily in well development. It's if they're going to be doing injection, we would generally have more oversight, and because there's an approval process that we review those permits for the injection, either for steam or for water disposal. But for just a purely standard production well,
typically just a standard extraction.
Yeah, we would typically have limited involvement, although the new SB 1137 is going to increase our involvement in that process if the wells are within a certain buffer. I forget it, maybe a quarter mile or a third of a mile of certain sensitive receptors, typically like homes or schools.
But if you're out in the middle of the Cuyaba Valley, for example,
we generally
there's no sensitive receptors.
Yeah, we
out
generally
there.
Wouldn't be notified.
Right. Okay. Thank you. Yes, Dr. Hunter and then Dr. Wolf.
We are seeing here a lot of different descriptions of the processes that we oversee. Are any of these considered fracking? Do we have fracking going on in our region?
We do not have any ongoing fracking. There's to my knowledge, maybe been only one or two wells that have ever been fracked in our region. That's more inland California occurrence, Kern County. And in fact, fracking's essentially been banned in California now for a couple of years, and we don't see it. To my knowledge, I have not heard that it's going to be restarting.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, the geology in our region doesn't make it profitable or worth it. So it's mostly steam injection and heat to get the oil to come out of the ground rather than any type of chemical or fracking.
Didn't we have some controversy about proposals for fracking in Monterey County? Don't I remember something about that?
There was a proposition on the ballot in Monterey County, but I think it was solely related to extraction and expansion of oil fields, I believe. I don't know, 2020
maybe. There were some local initiatives to ban fracking, but there was no fracking going on.
Okay.
So it was more of people thinking that we were going to get in front of this. I think similarly in San Luis Obispo County, there was some movement on that.
Yeah.
And the reality is there's no fracking going on here. So even if they passed it, it would have no impact.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Any other questions or comments? Yes, Dr. Wolf.
Yeah, so drilling on the issue a little more, no puns intended. looking at exploratory wells, you know, when you're saying we don't have any involvement. Typically, if you're going to drill even an exploratory well, you may penetrate through different aquifer zones. So it seems somewhat paradoxical, in a sense, that we don't even have a notification. I'm not suggesting all the way through a permit process, but. You know, if I take drinking water wells, for example, I mean, you can't just willy-nilly, even for an exploratory well, you can't just say, oh, I'm going to do an exploratory well. Trust me, it's all going to be good. So I don't know. I find that a little bit odd. I do get your point about, you know, if you're in the boonies, but
I bring that up because there is an exploratory well being drilled in the Cuyama Valley. I'm citing a very specific example, and we don't have any oversight over that. So I didn't pull it out of thin air, and I'm honestly not. I do find it just as befuddling as you do, because we're drilling through certain aquifer zones.
Exactly.
And it's also a critically overdrafted basin. So there's a whole host of issues there.
Yeah, because you get into, you know, the issues of the sealing of the casing, you know, to prevent cross-contamination between zones, et cetera. And yes, you know, I didn't mention, you know, your example as being a hypothetical example. I know there's activity there, but I'm just bringing to the surface the oddity, I would say, that, you know, we're not informed from a sister agency, because it should be bilateral. Sometime we remind, well, you don't notify us when you're doing X, Y, Z. Well, it should work both ways. I'm just putting it out there.
I hear your concerns. And I would like to add that CalGEM does have pretty extensive regulations in place to, both with sealing the annular spaces around the casing to prevent fluid migration between protected freshwater zones and oil-bearing zones. They have pretty extensive regulations in place regarding the construction of oil and gas wells to try to mitigate that. But yeah, there's no process in place that automatically triggers us to review those.
Mr. Lodge.
Yeah, not only that, but it's really in the oil producer's best interest to isolate any type of water sources. There's enough water. Most of the fluid they're pulling out of the ground from the production zone is actually water, and so they do want to isolate those drinking water sources or any other type of water to get in there, because they want to minimize the amount of fluids they have to pull out of the ground, because it's a significant management issue to deal with that produced water once it's on the surface, and so they want to minimize that as much as possible. And yeah, to Joey's point, CalGEM has significant regulations in place to ensure that those zones are isolated, and they're often, you know, that we're talking about thousands of feet often to the production zones. It's not a few hundred feet from usually from a drinking water source to a production zone.
I think we get that. I think it's just, it is sort of curious. Yeah. It is a little bit curious why we wouldn't even receive a notification.
Yeah, we don't really have any authority in the putting in production wells or whatnot. Where we come in is, again, when they're going to inject any type of fluid into the subsurface.
Okay. Yes, thank you. Any other questions, comments? Okay.
Great. That's it for my section. So it might be a good time for a break or pass it on to Mary.
Do we want to have a break? Your thoughts? But just strictly 10 minutes, like really strictly 10 minutes. Because, okay, great. So 10:55 on the dot, all. We'll be right back. So I'm sorry, I broke my own 10-minute rule, and it's 13 minutes. It's 10:58. We're going to call the meeting back to order. And we'll just carry on with the updates, if that's okay. I hope so. Thank you.
So it's back to me, Harvey Packard. We're a couple more, and then we'll let Mary talk about her programs. 401 certification program. Again, we heard a lot of good detail yesterday from Phil Hammer, the program manager. He's got 6 scientists in this program. I just want to say, if you're going to remember anything about 401 certification, remember avoid, minimize, mitigate. That's really what they try to concentrate on as far as water quality impacts. And then the general order is taking up a big part of the program's time this fiscal year. Anything from the board on that one?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
Thank you.
Stormwater. Another one of Leah Lemoyne's programs. 6 scientists. Let's see, a lot of great detail in August. Well, any new positions. Actually, that's not correct.
Okay.
Yes, that was a paste and copy. Copy-paste. Yeah, it's not. She has a combination of scientists, geologists, engineers. This was also one of the programs where we lost a position permanently.
Mm-hmm.
So that's going to affect that work. So here's my notes. 4 engineers, geologists, and scientists, 1 student, 1 position lost to budget cuts.
Is that accurate, Ms. Lemoyne?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Get on the right slide. Targets, again, these are based on EPA requirements. They want to see us inspect a certain percentage of permitted sites each year, so that turns out to 6 municipal sites, 72 construction sites, and 90 industrial stormwater sites. And as far as picking out, which ones we decide to look at, we look at... for municipal, we're concentrating on compliance with TMDLs and enforcement of construction general permit and onboarding new staff.
Yes, Mr. Rodriguez.
Quick question, Harvey. Are we doing any stormwater capture / whether it's for to put it back into the aquifer or mm-hmm. recycle it?
Yes. And it's actually an emphasis from the state. We got a brand new position to work on that specifically. We do have some sites that are doing it already, but we're going to be looking at that more closely, facilitating that kind of work, trying to figure out what kind of permitting is appropriate. We do have a few already in the region. I think a couple on golf courses where they can direct runoff into dry wells for recharge, things like that. The RCD of Santa Cruz County is involved in small-scale recharge projects on ag lands in association with Pajaro Valley Water Management Agency and UC Santa Cruz. So there's some good stuff to build on there, too.
Thank you.
Okay, you can carry on.
Okay, last one for me is our wildfire resiliency program. Phil Hammer is the program manager, and currently there is 1 geologist assigned to this program. And that PY is concentrated on regulatory oversight of fire-related activities, both pre-fire and post-fire, mostly pre-fire. We're trying to get a handle, well, utility companies especially are doing a lot of work on mitigating fire risk. Some of that involves work in waterways that we are involved in regulating. So that's primarily what this program does.
Thank you. Questions, comments? Yes, Dr. Wolf.
Our interaction with CAL FIRE, can you comment on that?
A lot of interaction with CAL FIRE, especially as the program is developing the general order that we're trying to get through. Lots of work, not just with CAL FIRE, but other with private property owners, other groups. But yeah, significant outreach and collaboration with CAL FIRE.
And Cal Poly has a forestry program within the College of Ag, Food, and Environmental Science. And within the forestry program, because of Swanton Ranch and the fires that took place there, they actually have a lot of work done collaboratively with CAL FIRE associated with fire prevention and also, you know, post-fire remediation, et cetera. Was wondering how plugged in we are with all that.
I'm not sure. Do you know, Phil, if we've been involved in any of that?
Hi, Phil Hammer, with Senior Environmental Scientist with the Wildfire Resiliency Program. We have not directly worked with Cal Poly faculty, but we are in direct contact with the SLO County Fire Consortium, which includes people from that group. We're working with them closely on this vegetation management order we're working on for fire risk reduction. So they're aware of the order. They've commented on it. We've met with them multiple times. So I feel like we are plugged into that type of group.
Yeah, and I mentioned it because they received significant grants, you know, to expand the program. And just as a little sideline, the student enrollment in the forestry program of Cal Poly has, in the last 2-3 years since the, you know, we started getting this increased amount of forest fires, has more than doubled.
Yeah.
And it's a very, very popular program for students to enroll in. Just as a side note.
No, there's a lot of resources available in this, in the field of, especially like prescribed fire and the like, and we're coordinating with those folks pretty extensively to make sure that what we're doing and what they're doing are aligned. We share common goals, but we got to make sure that we can both, you know, meet them and allow this important work to go forward as well.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments on this? Okay. Thank you.
All right. Mary, you're up.
Thanks, Harvey. How's the volume on this? Okay. A little closer. Mary Hamilton, an environmental program manager for the section that includes water quality standards, surface water planning and assessment, grants, and the non-point source permitting programs for irrigated lands and cannabis. In the series of slides you're going to see next, I didn't include specific mention of the priority for recruitment and retention of qualified and well-trained staff, but I hope it's evident to everyone that that is a priority for all of us and all of our programs. And you'll hear more, as Ryan mentioned, about our efforts related to workforce planning and mentoring. And I do also want to mention that in all of the programs that I work with, we spend a lot of time on hiring, training, onboarding, mentoring. And although that's not reflected here on the slides or in the document specifically, it's important to mention that. I'm grateful that Angela did put that as bullets in her work. So thanks for that reminder.
I'm just going to interject. I think part of the workforce retention is mentoring, right? Making
Absolutely.
Sure that there's enough opportunity for transfer of knowledge and growth and support. I think that's huge. So I appreciate the focus and attention on that.
Thank you. Agreed. So irrigated lands program, we'll start here. If you're looking in the strategic plan document, we're on page 22 now. And again, going in the order that they're mentioned in that document. This program is managed by Elaine Saul, a senior environmental scientist. We have four environmental scientists, an engineering geologist, water resource control engineer, and an AGPA staff in this unit, as well as a technical senior, Paula Richter. And for the meantime, another technical senior, James Bishop, who's working on groundwater-related elements of work plan development for groundwater trends monitoring, and also the alternative water supply program. So together, all of us work as a team with Elaine to implement the agricultural order, which regulates discharges from commercially irrigated lands to protect surface water and groundwater quality. There's currently just over 1,700 operations enrolled in the agricultural order, and that covers about 410,000 acres of irrigated lands. Our general projects or priorities and tasks for the fiscal year include implementing the ag order, and that's a nice tidy bullet to put on this slide, but that really includes a lot of things, including ongoing outreach and education. We continue to host and plan workshops, develop additional YouTube tutorial videos to help with compliance assistance. We have a dedicated, what we call Ag NOI, email and phone line where staff are available during business hours every day to assist with any number of things. We continue to share data and compliance information and build additional website tools. One big one being our dashboards, our series of data and information that you can find about enrollment and reporting and how we're doing with nitrogen applied and nitrogen removed, as well as groundwater quality and surface water quality. Staff also have many other tools they continue to develop about how to report and comply with the various requirements. And then, of course, staff have been focusing this year on identifying and enrolling what we call non-filers. So those are growers who should enroll that are not yet enrolled or not currently enrolled. And they also, part of the implementation of the order is, of course, assessing compliance, tracking violations, and following up accordingly.
So with the non-filers, for example, Ms. Hamilton, are you working with Central Coast Preservation, Inc. on the identification and communication to her and her group to help also nudge those folks along?
Yeah, a little bit, but that is primarily driven by our staff, and we've developed some tools to identify areas that appear to be commercial agricultural lands and are sending out letters. It's been a big focus, which you will all hear a lot more about next month or 2 months from now in our next annual update. But yeah, there is absolutely coordination with third party. And that's the next bullet that you'll see here. And coordination with the third party is another big part of what we do day to day. We have routine meetings with them. Every week, basically, we have one meeting or another with the third party to discuss all matter of things related to implementation. And then this year, we're also working on revising the ag order to comply with the remands order issued by the State Board last September, and also facilitate the development and implementation of our alternative water supply program. We don't officially have State Water Board targets for this program, so you won't find ag program targets on the performance tracking page. However, we do track percent acres enrolled and percent operations enrolled based on the estimates for those in our region.
Can you just comment on the development of the alternative water supply program and the funding that would be associated with it? Because there is no stipulated funding from State Board. Is that correct?
Correct. Yeah. The State Board directed us in their remands order to develop an alternative water supply program that contains both short-term and long-term solutions for residents in our region that are using domestic wells contaminated with nitrate as a result of agricultural operations. And so right now we are working on identifying that footprint of those areas that have agricultural influence that is resulting in nitrate exceeding the maximum contamination level. We are also going to be working to develop the program to administer this, and this program will be funded by dischargers per the remands order.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I mean, given the staffing that we have, I appreciate all the work and focus that's going into that.
Thank you. That's all I have. Any other questions? Again, we will have a really detailed presentation and staff report for you guys in December.
Thank you. Okay, we can go on.
All right. Next is our cannabis regulatory program, which continues to be managed by Arwen. She is doing a lot. She's a senior WRCE, and she continues to manage this program while we're working towards hiring a new senior ES, which has been delayed by the budget issues. This program regulates waste discharges from cannabis cultivation operations and implements the statewide cannabis policy. Our region has approximately one-third of this the statewide enrolled cultivation acreage, despite the fact that we have relatively fewer sites. So we have larger sites. We have fewer, but larger cannabis operations enrolled than some of the other regions. The program currently has only one staff person, an engineering geologist, and one vacancy, but hiring for that is on hold and has been for a couple of months now due to the budget discussions that are ongoing. This program also lost a position due to the budget reductions that were implemented earlier this year. So this program's already been understaffed for quite some time. General priorities and tasks for this fiscal year are to identify and regulate unenrolled sites and to regulate enrolled sites, which includes inspections, compliance assistance for enrollment, riparian corridor protection requirements, and helping people understand that. And lots of coordination with the State Water Board and CDFW, California Department of Fish and Wildlife, on aerial imagery that we use to identify non-enrolled locations. Staff also assists with law enforcement on warrant operations and follow-up as needed, and that does require additional multi-agency coordination for those warrant operations to inspect sites. And then staff continue to work on enrollment and remediation or cleanup of those sites if needed, and could include additional follow-up actions. This year, staff are also going to be working on coordinating with the next steps related to a cleanup and abatement order that's currently issued in Santa Barbara County. And you'll notice that there are no State Water Board performance targets for this program.
So just a question. I mean, when we first started, I think the preponderance of growers were in Santa Barbara County. Is that still the case, or are they now a little bit more geographically distributed?
I'm going to defer to Arwen on that one.
Okay.
I believe that's true. Santa Barbara is a large percentage, but
yeah,
she knows. Perfect.
Yeah. Arwen Wyatt, Mayor, Cannabis Program Manager. Yes, so Santa Barbara County has been pretty forward-thinking in terms of permitting and wanting to really facilitate the permitting, so that is where most of our enrollments still are. We do have a big chunk in Monterey County. We certainly have some in San Luis Obispo County and Santa Cruz, and then little bits in our other counties. Santa Barbara has the big sites, though.
Well, we have all the greenhouses down in Carpinteria,
yeah.
And then there's lots of area up in other portions. So
yeah. Okay. Monterey County only allowed cannabis primarily in existing greenhouse structures, so that kind of limited things. Santa Barbara County did establish a acreage cap for the county, which they've reached, but they were more permissive in general, trying to get people enrolled and moving things forward.
Yeah. And have we seen a decrease in the northern portion of the county, let's say Tepesque Canyon, where there's a lot of rugged terrain and lots of off-the-map grows?
Yeah, and there have been some, the term is going to slip my mind, existing residential.
It's an EDRN, existing
yeah.
residential, no, existing rural developed
yeah,
neighborhood,
there you go. Yeah. Yeah, so there have been some areas where they've banned them.
Right, around yeah. those EDRNs,
yes.
yeah. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Sarah.
Any other questions? Okay.
Okay. Next is the non-point source program, which is managed by Daniel Ellis, a senior environmental scientist who you heard from yesterday. Our non-point source program is a required component of the Federal Clean Water Act framework to restore and protect our nation's waters. And in California, the non-point source program works to reduce discharges of non-point source pollution to waters of the state and to mitigate those impacts. Staff positions in the Irrigated Lands Program and Grants Program are funded by federal funds from Nonpoint Source. but there are no official non-point source program staff. Daniel Ellis handles the reporting and the work that we do to inform US EPA and State Board of our plans. So that includes tracking and reporting on various program activities, such as irrigated lands program activities related to nitrogen applied and nitrogen removed, and also activities in other programs that are related to non-point source. So Daniel handles the reporting, which means it's the development of a five-year plan, as well as each year an annual plan, which is what we were working on this year, and reporting on our progress and the tasks identified in those plans, both annually and semi-annually to US EPA. So we submit a work plan that is approved by EPA, and then we report twice a year on our progress. There are no State Board performance targets for this program either. Okay, so before we step into the Basin Planning Program, I just want to think back to yesterday, and Daniel mentioned the synergy between the water quality standards, planning, assessment, grants, and non-point source programs, and give a quick reminder of the Clean Water Act approach to restore and maintain the chemical, physical, and biological integrity of our nation's waters. And that is implemented in the Clean Water Act by a series of programs that work together to accomplish this. So obviously step one is establish water quality standards. So assign beneficial uses to water bodies, establish criteria to protect those uses. And then we monitor, collect data, and determine, assess if those water quality standards are met or achieved. That's the integrator report program. Any water bodies that are not meeting their designated beneficial uses are then added to what we call the Clean Water Act Section 303D list, and that becomes the to-do list for the TMDL program, or Total Maximum Daily Load program, which develops strategies to control sources, control loading, and restore the quality of those waters so that beneficial uses are attained. And TMDLs are implemented through various mechanisms. They are only enforceable if they are included in a permit or an order or other enforceable order, permit, or by prohibitions. It's also implemented via grants and voluntary actions like development of a non-point source management plan. So I just wanted to provide that framework because the next several programs I'm going to talk about, as Daniel mentioned yesterday, his team works together and overlaps quite a bit. So we're starting here with the Basin Planning Program, which you heard quite a bit about yesterday, so I'll keep this one brief. Managed by Daniel Ellis, our senior ES in that group. And this year, we're going to be working on ongoing support for use and understanding of water quality control plans and policies, both our basin plan and statewide plans and policies. We, of course, focus on work related to our basin plan in this program. Conduct the triennial review, which you all adopted yesterday, and our priorities for future work on basin plan amendments. And then the rest of the program work for the one staff environmental scientist in this program will be related to work to develop those high-priority basin plan amendments so that we can bring those to the board in the near future. And that includes both coordination with technical experts needed to do the technical justification for amendments sometimes, and also the administrative process to bring items to this board. We do have a statewide performance target for this program, and it is simply the number of basin plan amendments that are adopted in a given fiscal year. And this year we don't have any, but as you may recall, we brought one to this board in June, and those do take a couple years typically to bring to completion. Any questions on that one? Okay. The next program I'll talk about is the TMDL, or Total Maximum Daily Load program, also managed by Daniel Ellis. And implemented by three program staff, two environmental scientists, and one water resource control engineer. This is down from four staff because we lost a position in this unit as well to the recent budget reductions earlier this year. Now, this program also implements the Clean Water Act requirements to address waters that are not meeting water quality standards and are on the 303D list. I do want to mention the 303D list currently has just over 1,200 water body and pollutant combination impairments. And as a reminder, the term impairment applies when a pollutant like nitrate occurs in amounts above the water quality objective, in this case an MCL, and therefore the beneficial use of drinking water is not attained. So a water body would be on the 303D list and considered impaired. I also want to point out that TMDLs that have been approved currently address about only 28% of those 1,200 impairments. And so the to-do list for this program is quite large. This year, staff are going to continue to align our priorities for which projects we'll be working on with this organization's priorities to address and prevent threats to human health and aquatic habitats, and also to ensure projects have multiple or related water quality issues and therefore are addressing multiple pollutants. This year, staff will continue to work on three projects. The Elkhorn Slough Nutrient and Biostem Responses Project is still in the development stage. The Lower Salinas Organophosphate Pesticides and Toxicity TMDL has been adopted by this board and is going to the State Water Board for approval in, I believe, April. It takes about 9 months from regional board approval to state board approval per their process. And then staff are also working on a neonicotinoid pesticide and toxicity TMDL for the Lower Salinas watershed, which will be the first of its kind, certainly in the state, and as far as we can tell in the nation, to address that class of pesticides, which is heavily used in that watershed. I will also mention that there are performance targets for this program, and they are, again, really simple. How many projects were adopted by the regional board in the fiscal year? And how many 303D listings were addressed in those projects in the fiscal year? So none. We don't have any coming to you before next June. That's because these projects take sometimes years and years to bring to the board. But I will say that the projects listed here, these three projects together, will address 90 impairments on the 303D list once they are finalized.
So on the neonicotinoid pesticide, which is the first in the nation, are you, obviously you're speaking with US EPA about this, and so how are those conversations going, and is there an opportunity for them to use that as a template for other areas, or do we not see the preponderance of those issues in other areas?
Good question. I'll let Daniel answer.
Go ahead.
Good morning. Daniel Ellis, senior ES over the TMDL program, and the other ones Mary already mentioned. So yes, there is definitely an opportunity for US EPA to kind of take this as a template and work with other states on it. We have been in really close contact with our liaison on it, sort of done some kind of an informal early consultation type meetings with US EPA. So they're aware of it. We've shared it on the roundtables with other regions as well. So that's definitely a big part of what we've been doing.
And so has it been well received?
Internally, yes, it's been very well received. I think a lot of the other regions are looking to us. We're one of the leaders in particularly pesticide TMDL, so yeah, been very well received.
Great. Good to know. Thank you.
I'll go ahead and brag a little bit and also mention that this region is a leader in collecting data on pesticides with both our CCAMP program and the requirements in the Agricultural Orders MRP to do pesticide monitoring. We've been collecting neonicotinoid data routinely throughout the region for quite some time, and so we have awareness of the geographic scope of these problems, where other regions are not as fortunate with robust monitoring programs.
Yeah, I think it's more than an awareness. I think it's like a deep understanding and knowledge that we have of all of these different types of, you know, toxicity and pesticides. And so yes, we've been a leader on that for decades. So I think that's great to brag about it.
Thank you. Daniel, you might as well hang out. I got two more programs that Daniel also manages. First up is the Integrated Report. This is a little out of order in terms of how the Clean Water Act would organize these programs. But regardless, Integrated Report Program is the name used to describe the program that does water quality data assessments and evaluates water quality standards attainment, so are the beneficial uses supported, and creates a 303D list of impaired waters, which becomes the TMDL program's to-do list. It also looks at the status of all water. So the 303D list is simply a list of waters not attaining water quality standards, and on this map on the slide, those would be waters that are shown in red, if you can see that color. The 305B report, which is also a section of the Clean Water Act, is a water quality condition report that we also send to EPA together with the 303D list, and that includes both waters meeting water quality standards, waters we don't have enough data and information to make a determination about, as well as the 303D list as part of that 305B report. So it tells us waters where we do have data telling us, yes, in fact, this water body is supporting beneficial uses. So another useful tool for us to evaluate where to focus our priorities for protection of high quality waters, as well as those waters not meeting water quality standards.
Yes, Dr. Hunter.
For streams where we don't have enough data, does anything occur with EPA? Do they do further review to determine if there is a need to expand to that area? What happens to those rivers and streams? I'm guessing they're small.
Good question.
Yeah.
I'll go ahead and jump in. Yes, but we wish we could do more, right? The wish list is great. In a lot of cases, we do provide feedback and say, this is a data gap, a need, you know, something's on the verge here. We have information implying there might be a problem, but not enough to be certain. We, of course, share that with programs that have monitoring authorities or our own ambient programs, but there are never enough resources to change permits and MRPs quickly to CCAMP can't do everything.
Yeah, right.
But, yeah, there is always discussion about the need to do more. And then there's the statewide swamp program, too, which does take some of that on, and they've done a great job. And I think Angela might be able to speak to some of those details at another when her slide comes up in just a sec.
Okay, then I'll be patient. Thank you.
So when we have water bodies with beneficial uses that are not on the 303D list, what's the process of listing and delisting them for beneficial and uses overall?
Just to be clear, I'm following your question. You're talking about like designating a water body with a new beneficial use? Yeah, so that would actually fall under the basin planning program realm. If we're de-designating a beneficial use, there's a very specific process. We do what's called a use attainability analysis, and we look into various factors to see if the use is being attained, can be attained, and then we go through that. To designate a new use, it's not a use attainability analysis, but a similar lift, and we look at all of that information and can bring it forth as a basin plan amendment.
Okay, and so to list something, what's that report called?
To list something on the integrated report?
Yes.
So that falls under what Mary was talking about with the 303D.
Okay, yeah. Okay. Thank you. Water quality objectives, also based in planning, but maybe you can answer. So do we have any site-specific water quality objectives in the Central Coast region?
We do have some, and then I'll actually go back to the triennial review that we mentioned yesterday, where one of the things on our previous list was some of those turbidity
right.
site-specific objectives. So yes, the answer to your question is yes, we do have some in our basin plan, and we also have some in the hopper where we could potentially work more to develop them if we have technical partners as well.
Okay, so having that technical partner, and that's probably a 2 to 3 year process, I would have been, yeah, okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the questions. So a couple more things to add for this program. This program operates without any dedicated staff. However, this program operates on a cycle. So every 6 years, three different regions are what we call on cycle, and those regions are expected to do a comprehensive assessment. So what that means is at a given date, if you're on cycle, you solicit data, gather all the available data and information, evaluate it, organize it, do the review, compare all that data to the relevant water body, pollutant, beneficial use, and water quality objective, and determine if it's meeting standards or not. We last updated our 303D list, or updated our integrated report, actually, in the 2002 cycle. And so we are on cycle in 2028. This year, that means we are in the soliciting data and organizing data phase. So staff are pulled from the TMDL program to work on this. One staff person, our WRCE, is working, our water resource control engineer, is working about 2/3 of her time in this fiscal year on those tasks. And so that is less resources for our recently reduced staff in the TMDL program to work on TMDLs. But I just want you to understand the balance of how we staff the work that needs to be done for this program. And there are no performance targets related to this program. Okay.
No questions.
One more for you, Dano. Last up is the grant programs, and we had a great discussion yesterday about the grants program. So I will simply share this beautiful photograph of one of the bioreactor projects that's in the Morro Coho Lower Salinas area. And the back side of that, or the top part of that, is also a wetland that is where the bioreactors discharge into. That wetland's been restored and is also part of the treatment process for this successful project, which has improved surface water in this area significantly. And then the priorities and tasks for Katie and the grants program, Katie and Daniel, and the grants program this year are to continue to solicit, review, and fund non-point source grants, work with the statewide programs, and really focus our efforts on getting the most bang for our buck and as much good funding in the hands of people who can do good work in this region. And then I also want to point out, as Katie mentioned, the focus of this program is to prioritize projects that will benefit underrepresented communities. That's a really important and high priority piece of what she does all the time. There are also no performance targets for this program.
I don't see any questions or comments. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Dana.
Great, so almost nearing the end here in our program priorities discussion, and I am really happy to be able to round out the conversation with regional monitoring. So we are very lucky here at the Central Coast Water Board to house two regional monitoring programs, our Central Coast Ambient Monitoring Program, as well as our Central Coast Ambient Monitoring Program groundwater assessment protection part of that. Most regional boards don't have the luxury of having in-house regional monitoring, and it's something that we've been able to do for a long time. So CCAMP is in my section. It's managed by Senior Environmental Scientist Specialist Melissa Doherty. CCAMP is our Central Coast regionally scaled surface water monitoring program, and we implement the program in very close coordination with the Bay Foundation of Morro Bay, and that's really how we're able to conduct this, this special regional monitoring. CCAMP has been collecting tens of thousands of data measurements related to surface water quality since 1998. And we have one of the largest water quality data sets in the region. Mary referenced that we incorporate that into our 303D list and integrated report. And so our primary goal is to collect, assess, and disseminate scientific information. We collect it through really robust surface water quality monitoring and design. And our goal is to be able to provide that water quality to our internal programs, as well as to the public and other water quality decision makers, to help us in making water quality decisions in the Central Coast. Our CCAMP program also serves as the regional component of the State Water Board's Surface Water Ambient Monitoring Program, or SWAMP. So for this year, our program priorities are to really coordinate closely with the Bay Foundation to ensure continuity in the program. As you know, as resources change and grow and decrease, it's really, programs that don't have regulatory mandates are the first ones that can be affected. And so we're really looking to the future to make sure that we have continuity. And one of the ways that we're doing that is to work very closely with the Bay Foundation to have a very robust collaboration. And so you heard Melissa this morning introduce Izzy Kent, which is our first full-time monitoring coordinator housed at the Bay Foundation. So we're trying to really create that continuity. We are also evaluating CCAMP program surface water quality monitoring strategies to maximize data quality given our changing resources. You've heard us in the past talk about increasing lab costs, for example, so we're really sort of evaluating our monitoring strategy this year. We are continuing to conduct our coastal confluences monitoring. We've been doing that for a long time. You've also heard us talk about our freshwater harmful algal bloom monitoring that we do. We do that in close coordination with the State Water Board, and that's generally associated with holidays where there's high water recreation in our region. All of that data is also on both the State Water Board and are linked from our Water Board's website. We also manage our CCAMP data and submit that data to the State Water Board, who upload it to CDEN, or the California Environmental Data Exchange Network. So that's an important part of what we're looking at doing this year. Also, we work with the Moss Landing Marine Laboratory to improve Data Navigator, and that's so the public has an opportunity to download our water quality data, and we share those tools also with our program staff and other partners. As Mary mentioned we also, Melissa also works to support the integrated report program when we're in cycle for doing that data analysis. We are also, it's not on the slide, but I wanted to mention that we're also looking toward increasing our collaboration with the Bay Foundation as it relates to coastal marine monitoring. So it's not something that we've been able to do in the future. They've got increased resources through their National Estuary Program, and so we're really looking to increase that collaboration as a way to grow our program that doesn't necessarily draw on our waterborne resources. And we don't have any program targets for this program. So I'll move on to the
question.
Yes.
Angela. Mm-hmm. I apologize. Can you go over the pre-holiday assessments? I wasn't quite clear on what that refers to.
Yeah, I'll let Melissa describe that in greater detail. So.
Hi, I'm Melissa Doherty. Yeah, I'm going to have to do that. So last year I gave you all an update. So the pre-holiday assessment is specifically targeting the harmful algal bloom program. So we collaborate with the State Water Board's freshwater harmful algal bloom program to sample pre-holidays, as Angela mentioned, for high-use recreation. So that typically is Memorial Day, pre-4th of July, and pre-Labor Day. So we sample those every year in coordination with the State Water Board to continue to monitor and track the changing conditions of those harmful algal blooms in our region.
So what is the value of conducting this pre-holiday assessment? What does it tell us, and what do we do with that information?
So we go out before the holiday event because we anticipate high recreation in our region. And so going out and ahead of the holiday season is we provide that publicly. So we submit those samples to the state board's contracted laboratory. We get that information back at a high priority. So the state board gets the information as well as myself, and then I coordinate with local water body managers to suggest or recommend various advisory postings if necessary, if there are certain toxins above thresholds that are harmful or pose a potential risk to human health.
Okay, and so is that freshwater and marine waters?
Technically, the program is freshwater and estuarine harmful algal bloom
estuarine
programs,
okay.
But our specific thresholds are meant for freshwater systems, so we tend to target our freshwater water bodies and reservoirs.
Okay. Have we had harmful algal blooms in our estuaries?
Yes, we have.
I'm not aware of that. Okay.
Yeah. So we do have marine harmful algal blooms, unfortunately. Those are typically referred to as red tides. So you may have seen in the news in the last few years, there were some marine wildlife that were affected by some of the marine diatom blooms.
Yeah. I'm aware of Monterey Bay in particular. But I
Our
guess
South
I'm,
Coast
yeah,
did
I'm
as
asking
well.
About the estuaries in particular.
Not locally in Morro Bay or an estuary local to us, but in Santa Barbara in Southern California, we did have some. Mammal.
Well, I'm glad
illness
we,
and die off. Yeah, unfortunately.
Yeah, I'm glad we escaped it here at Morro Bay.
Yeah, we were fortunate in our most local estuarine watershed. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank
but
you.
We have quite a bit. I have to say, in Santa Barbara County, I mean, about a year and a half ago, I would go every Saturday at the beach, and there was one. Yeah, at least one dolphin washed up on the shore. Oh. It's just horrifying.
Yeah, the dolphins was a newer occurrence, but our sea lions, seals are affected.
Yeah, they're also affected. They get really confused. It's really awful thing.
Yeah, it's a narrow
watch. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Mr. Rodriguez.
A quick question, just for my own clarity. When we talk about water bodies, lakes, rivers, creeks, streams, reservoirs, is that all included in there?
So our regional monitoring program?
Yes.
Yes, it definitely, we target all of the different water bodies.
Ponds.
Creeks, not typically ponds, especially if they're on private properties, but creeks, rivers, estuaries, reservoirs, lakes, nearshore environments when we have lagoon sampling. We've done some special studies in harbors. So I use the term broadly. It's all water bodies. But the harmful algal bloom pre-holiday assessments typically are lakes and reservoirs.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Melissa. So finally, I'll discuss the Central Coast Ambient Monitoring Program groundwater assessment protection. Again, this is a regional monitoring program that we are lucky to have in our region, and it's managed by senior environmental scientist Julia Dyer. This is a program that we began in 2012. You might recall that Matt Keeling was our first CCAMP GAP program coordinator. So we implement this program in very close coordination with the Bay Foundation also. And this part of the program focuses on regional groundwater monitoring programs and implementation of groundwater-related projects that evaluate, restore, and protect the beneficial uses of groundwater, especially drinking water. So for fiscal year 24-25, our CCAMP GAP program priorities include to continue to implement our Central Coast Drinking Water Well Testing Program. It's our free drinking water well testing program. We are currently in Santa Cruz County. For 24 and 25, though, we're expanding to Santa Barbara and San Luis Obispo counties. And we do that in very close coordination with the Division of Drinking Water, the Office of Public Participation, local agencies, and community partners. And for Santa Cruz and also for Santa Barbara, I'm pleased to report that Julia has had the opportunity to have really active engagement with the local agencies. We also support regional groundwater monitoring projects. So an example of that is our technical assistance for limited resource and socially disadvantaged growers to be able to assist them with their well monitoring and reporting. And we do that in close coordination with Sarah Lopez at Central Coast Water Quality Preservation, Inc. We're also coordinating with the Division of Drinking Water, Division of Financial Assistance, the Safe and Affordable Funding for Equity and Resilience SAFER program, local agencies and community organizations to support safe drinking water programs. So really early in our program, we recognize we can't test wells without having replacement water immediately available. And so we've worked hard to build these resources, and we have our Central Coast Regional Bottled Water Program, which is currently implemented by Community Water Center. And then we're also working with counties. So, for example, Santa Cruz County also has a replacement water program.
Angela, do we have a sense of how much SAFER funding has positively impacted our Central Coast region?
That's a good question. I'm not sure if Julia has an answer. We can definitely work to find that out. I know related to Community Water Center on its own, we have over $1.5 million of SAFER funding in our region.
Hi, Ms. Dyer.
Hi, Julia Dyer, Senior Environmental Scientist for CCAMP GAP. And in addition to the SAFER funding received by Community Water Center, the County of Santa Cruz has about $600,000 in SAFER funding. And they're the only county in our region with SAFER funding at this time.
Interesting. That's very good to know. I appreciate
that. And $1.8 million for the TCP continuation.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
And I know that Taya and Mary are working hard to work with the local agencies to take continuing to take advantage of the SAFER funds for replacement water.
Yeah.
We're also, as you know,
I'm sorry. Yeah, go ahead. I'm going to interrupt you. Ms. Tryon.
I wanted to interrupt Mary earlier, but I didn't find the right moment. Just for the record, I wanted to clarify something that she mentioned is that the alternative water supply program that was directed by the State Water Board for us to implement includes all groundwater that residents depend on, not just domestic wells. And so if it was domestic wells, it might be a simpler program, but this is all programs, and so it's immense.
It's immense, and we are the most groundwater-dependent region in the entire state of California.
Exactly.
Thank you.
Great, thank you. So to continue, we are coordinating with the Rose Foundation to implement the Central Coast Community-Based Water Quality Grants Program. So you'll hear more about this in December, but we're pleased to report that the Rose Foundation has completed the process to allocate and award the approximately $1.2 million in grant funds. And we'll hear more about those projects in the next board meetings. For 24-25, it'll actually begin the implementation of those specific projects. And then finally, we're looking to evaluate opportunities to establish a regionally scaled groundwater quality trend monitoring program for the Central Coast region, and especially in the context of our domestic drinking water well program. So we'll be looking at how we can continue to implement that program in a way where we can look at sort of trends in domestic well water quality. And this is another area where we are very fortunate to get from state board resources to hire a paid intern. Unfortunately, that's been delayed a little bit through the hiring freeze too, but we hope to have that resource as well.
Sorry, Dr. Hunter has a question.
Question. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Angela. Regarding free well testing, I think we were the first in the state to implement free well testing. I know the State Water Board looked at our program and then took steps to bring that to other regions. Do we know how many other regions currently have free well testing?
So the State Water Board's GAMMA program started free drinking water well testing back in, I think, 1997. I was part of that program. We brought it here to this region in also in the context of our irrigated lands program. So at the same time that we were developing those monitoring requirements is when we established the opportunity to do the free drinking water well testing program. It was actually Matthew Keeling who was able to get the funding. That was the hard part, right, was the funding for the free drinking water well testing program. Mm-hmm. Region 5, I believe, also has drinking water well testing happening. Most other regions, I'm not sure if it, of the other regions who do it, but Region 5 at least is doing it through contracts. Okay. So we are the only region that does it through our collaboration with Bay Foundation, where our regional board staff can be involved in that.
Right. And the Community Water Center also is facilitating.
Yes. So that's the other big part of it, is that we coordinate with our local agencies and community partners to do the outreach, right? So Community Water Center has taken a very large role in community engagement. There's kind of a synergistic relationship where we work with local agencies and local partners to do the outreach. Mm-hmm. We do, with the Bay Foundation, the well testing and the replacement water programs, okay. But it also provides the opportunity to learn more about where the Community Water Center and other partners focus on long-term drinking water solutions, right? So it's kind of this outreach and well testing and replacement water sort of feeds each other to help improve drinking water well quality on the Central Coast.
Right. Well, I stand corrected on the State Water Board. I wasn't aware of that.
It's a very small program. I don't think they implement it anymore. But it's the impetus for the programs are all nitrate drinking water.
Okay. All right. So we're in line with that. Yeah. Thank you.
And that concludes our program priorities presentation.
We're not quite
in. Oh, I'm sorry. How could I forget?
I will be discussing
but
the last
two. Thank you, Ms. Schroeder.
Sorry to get all excited. But
no.
There's
I
two more.
There are. We have enforcement and administrative programs.
Yes. So each section manager reports to myself, the assistant executive officer, and the enforcement program and the administrative program also directly report to myself. Because the enforcement program and the administrative programs support all of the programs and staff. And so let's focus on the enforcement program first. Enforcement program, I'm very fortunate to have Tamara Anderson manage all the projects and coordination. And then we have one staff engineer as well. So it's a small team. And our key function is to really support staff and managers in doing effective enforcement strategies. You've seen throughout these program presentations enforcement as a priority for a lot of the programs. It's a lot of work. There's a lot of violations, and we have to pick and choose which ones we pursue. When it comes to penalties or complaints, administrative civil liability complaints, the enforcement team typically takes the lead we also manage the mandatory minimum penalties, which are required by law to be imposed. And Todd Stanley, our engineer, he manages, tracks them, because they all get inputted, the effluent limit violations all get inputted into CWIX, our, one of our databases. He mines that to make sure that we are applying the mandatory minimum penalties, and typically through our expedited payment program. We have some performance targets relative to the mandatory minimum penalties, and how those are looked at is someone at State Board looks at our CWIX, our database. Oh, there's about 155 violations that need to be addressed, so they give us those targets, and we process them within an 18-month time frame.
So the big egregious violations, million gallon spills, for example, those are typically Class A violations. And so we also track resolving those violations. And for this fiscal year, we have 3 Class A violations that we're going to be addressing. And then on top of just working on enforcement projects with staff, we're really focused in on developing the skills and the knowledge for the new staff coming in and some of the new managers on how to do effective enforcement, how to set it up, how to do inspections, what type of thing you have to, you know, really have documentation on and proper documentation, and then coaching on the different types of things you could do to bring the discharger back into compliance. One of the other effective things that I believe is a key function of the enforcement program is the coordination we do, not only with our internal staff, but also with State Board Office of Enforcement staff and various local agencies, Environmental Health, District Attorney's Office, Fish and Wildlife, many discussions and collaborations on big projects that we can partner on. So we talked about the mandatory minimum penalties and doing that enforcement. We are also probably one of the programs that you're most familiar with because we bring to the board our enforcement reports often, and every year we provide you with our general priorities. And so we prioritize enforcement on irrigated lands, and I wanted to do a shout out to Paula Richter, who's our enforcement coordinator specific to irrigated lands, which helps us do more. And then, you know, the violations that really need our attention to bring dischargers back into compliance, or to really address those dischargers that are getting an economic advantage by not being in compliance with our requirements. And that's a fairness thing for those that are being in compliance. So that's, we do a lot of things in the enforcement program, but that's kind of it in a nutshell. Any questions? Okay. Next, last but not least, is the administrative program. That program is managed by our staff services manager, Sarah Hewawitharana. Probably did not say that right, but we call her Sarah H. And she has 2 staff that report directly to her, and then we also have 1 staff that is specific to irrigated lands because of how much administrative work they do. And that's been a real excellent asset to helping Sarah's team focus on more of the business operations of how we keep our office running. And one of our priorities for this coming fiscal year is to build that team again, because 2 years ago we had no admin staff and it was painful. And I think they're really unsung heroes, really, because there's so much that goes on behind the scenes that our staff can't do our work unless those things happen. So we're very fortunate to have that, and we're continuing to build that team, and we have 1 vacancy we still need to fill. And also, not having a clerk to the board, some of that work has spread amongst the little bit of admin staff we do have. So we look forward to that opportunity on onboarding a new person. And we're continually developing procedures and increasing efficiencies. The way that we coordinate with State Board, there always seems to be a new form you need to fill out, and there always seems to be a new database you have to put something in. And so just keeping up with the process has been quite a task, and figuring out efficiencies. Health and safety is also a real key component that we need to update and train staff on, especially since we have a lot of new staff. And we're going to continue to work on backlog projects. Hopefully you had a chance to walk around upstairs and you don't see as many pieces and parts laying around, and that's all one of those backlog projects that were had to be put on hold that we're starting to get to. So that wraps it up for all the programs. There's a lot of programs And I hope today was really eye-opening for all of you on how much we do and then how much we don't do and how hard it is to prioritize. And I know our staff are, a lot of the stress associated with the workload stress is because we want to do it all. We're all very passionate about water quality and getting things done and being responsible and really coordinating with the public. And we just can't do it all. And it's really difficult. And so we're hoping that these are going to be the tools we need with you, with our external partners and internally to say, here's this new thing we need to do. The Diablo Canyon permit, for example, that is a huge lift. So which, if we're going to do that, what can't we do? And that's kind of what we're trying to do with these, is being transparent about what we can do and then using it as a tool to say, this new thing came in, that means this thing can't happen. So thank you for the opportunity to share these.
Yes, thank you. Appreciate it, Taya.
This might be early, but I just want to thank everybody from the executive officer, our assistant executive officer / temporary clerk of the board, at the section managers, and everybody that came up and answered questions. It was very insightful, and even though I've been on the board for a year and a half now, I feel like I've been here for a long time, and I know I haven't, when I hear all the various programs that we have. And again, thank you, everybody, for what you put together for us.
Yeah, I was going to say the same. It's been a great introduction for me in particular, and found the materials, not just for the strategic plan, but all the materials for this board meeting to be very comprehensive. And I know it takes a long time to put all that together. So really appreciate all of your work. Thanks.
Dr. Hunter.
She knew.
I love you, Monica.
Mutual. I wanted to say, in addition to thank you, of course, and that comment on the quality of the work, which is always very high. I always appreciate that. But I think another aspect of this is how much work goes into doing this update and organizing it and making it succinct and in ways that we can digest all these complications, and recognizing that the data we're collecting is ever growing, the technology we manage and the training going into that, new design of database, and as you said, the input of these of this data going into it requires constant attention. And I know it's across the state, but I think in our region in particular, we have always had that intent of developing really powerful data sets and using that to drive our work. And I know Angela and I had many conversations about the well testing program in the early stages of that, with awareness that we needed to break through to public health, environmental health agencies in our region, and that we weren't really being heard until we showed up with real numbers, which really then emphasized where the problems are. And then fixing those problems requires program partners and leveraging with other agencies, recognizing some of that overlap and hopefully gaining efficiencies there in coordination and collaboration with these agencies. So I really, really value these moments. So as much work as it takes to put this into place for us and for the public, I think going forward, it's going to be very helpful to us to keep all of this in mind, because now we're looking at, you know, perhaps permanent staff cuts, hopefully never furloughs, but we have to be mindful of what those limits represent. And I know I will be, and again, just appreciate the quality of the work that's always, it's very consistent here. I can't think of anything where we've come to a point where we just, what? You know, we're not prepared. We are prepared. So thank you again to everybody.
Yeah, I just wanted to say we're not done with the presentation.
Oh, we're
so
not done.
Yeah, we have some more slides.
Do it again.
That's okay.
Oh,
we're yeah. Jeez. But I'm going to hold my comments, but
it was
go ahead.
So much.
No, it's just one thing when you mention data, and I'm sure it's already been thought of because everyone talks about it now, but certainly it comes up in the private sector a lot where I spend more of my time, and that is the role of artificial intelligence and whether there's any opportunity here when you look at the massive amount of data and work that you're all doing, if there's opportunities, you know, as we look forward and we're being asked to report out on more things and, you know, even the PowerPoints and everything, you know, there's potentially opportunity and maybe you're already exploring that, but it does seem that you really have to leave the session realizing that you all have just an incredible amount of information that you're managing on top of everything else. So I'm not an expert on artificial intelligence. I'm just telling you that almost everywhere I go, it's mentioned as something that's supposed to be able to be helping us in managing and communicating. So I don't know, Ryan, I don't know if that just means we're just adding something else to your plate to look at, which was not the intention.
Potentially. I don't have a great answer for you. I'll have to talk to staff about whether we're looking into AI to help us with any of our programmatic work or go through data and evaluate that. It's something that we may want to look into.
Well, we're very fortunate to have one of the leads for Department of Information Technology here today. I will say, personally, this is my personal opinion. Being in California, I am actually very surprised at how behind we are in terms of IT with the state. And I would love to see advances in that, but there are security issues that are at the core. But I'm sure that's Kevin can talk about.
Yes, thank you. My name is Kevin Heineman, Department of Information Technology. We are currently looking at AI and how it can help. We actually are having a Copilot, which is the built-in AI with the Windows system. We're actually in a training right now. I've got a lot of our staff learning how that can help us in the future. One of the things that was mentioned was analyzing data. You know, that takes so many man hours to get through that. Also, response to comments, summarizing all the letters that we get. Those type of things. We are behind. We are worried about security, as Taya mentioned. We also need to make sure that what we're producing is accurate. We are very concerned with the accuracy. We don't want anything to come out from an AI system that now binds the state of California and the water boards to a decision or a comment. So we are also under the preview of the California Department of Technology. They have been slow with, I won't say slow, they've been very cautious about moving forward. So they want to make sure everything is secure, provides accurate information before we move forward. But long way to say, we are looking into it. We definitely see really good uses for it with that data analysis and other things that can help our staff, especially now with the staffing cuts that we're experiencing.
So Tamara did remind me that Cannabis has an AI-type technology that they use satellite imagery to identify potential cannabis grows.
Yeah, and I do think, like, when you look at the comment summaries, it was yesterday, right, where we had so many comments, and then you have to go through and show them. Obviously, you have to go back and check for accuracy and reviewing, but it really could be something that might take away some of the work that just is time consuming and
absolutely.
Let you prioritize staff time and
the response to comments is one of the things that actually came up specifically as something that AI could go through and summarize. Obviously we'd want staff to validate for accuracy, but the initial first cut could definitely be something AI could take over for us. Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Lodge.
Thank you. Next slide, please. So as you can see, we have a lot of programs, a lot of program commitments, and limited resources. A lot of what we do is not captured, to Angela's point, in the prioritization document. Emails, phone calls, complaints, public record act requests, spill responses. It all adds to the daily work volume, and interacting with the public is important, and it is a priority for us, so we have to be responsive to those requests and to that information. But capturing that volume of work in this plan is difficult to do. So while it's critical to prioritize our programmatic work, it's also critical that we prioritize our staff development and support of our staff. So to that, we have initiated a workforce planning and development process this year. We're in the transition period. We acknowledge that in the organization. We've talked about that before. We've had a lot of retirements in the past 5 years, a lot of new staff, very highly qualified staff, as you can tell when we hire. There's a lot of really good credentials, a lot of great experience. I'm very proud of the staff that we have and the work that they do. But we did navigate through COVID, 100% telework. Now we're back to a hybrid work environment, and our staff has done an amazing job focused on water quality and also helping each other through these difficult times and supporting each other professionally as well. And as it's been mentioned before, recruiting, hiring, and retaining highly qualified staff is a priority for us. But it does take time. When we're actually allowed to do that, it does take time and it takes resources to do that, but it is critical. But with new staff, we need to commit to providing them with opportunities to grow and to gain knowledge in our organization and our programs. Our workload and our complexity of the work continue to grow, as you've seen in the last couple of days with the program priorities and the program updates. It doesn't get any easier. We just add to the complexity with the different constituents and the different requirements and recycled water and the Diablo Canyon project, and it just layers on the complexity. So in this past year, our workforce planning and development efforts included a staff-led discussion related to their highest priorities. They met in groups and without management in the room. They talked about certain topics, knowledge and skills, managing assignments and workload, and preparing for professional growth. We asked the questions, what is working, what is not working, and what actions they suggest to correct those issues. There were some common themes that came up. I think that's the next slide. Some common things came up during this process, not surprisingly, I guess, the need for increased training, cross-programmatic work opportunities, professional development, workload management improvements, and mentoring opportunities. We received over 160 specific actions in this exercise, so we boiled those down to 50 similar actions, and we sent a survey to staff to try to drop it down, so we asked for their top five to make a manageable list. Following the survey, we established a staff-led workforce planning committee. So we have five staff that volunteered to go through those survey results. They're tasked with providing suggested actions, updating management and staff, and coming up with proposed plan to implement those actions. That committee provided an update at our August staff meeting, and I checked in with them last week, and they're close to providing management with that plan. We also had seniors and section managers participate in their own meeting to go through the same questions as staff, and we're in the process of developing a survey to address some of the seniors and section managers' issues that they've identified. We have addressed some of the issues in terms of meeting management, shortening meetings, canceling other meetings, or eliminating them. We've also recently provided leadership training in the form of communication work. We call it our DISC training. We're also providing coaching opportunities for our staff and management, just all in terms of communication and also leadership opportunities to help them. And then also another effort that we've done is initiating a staff mentoring pilot program. So next up, we're gonna have Karen Steckling and Leah Lemoyne, and they're gonna discuss that pilot program. We initiated that, I believe, about 6 months ago, and so they're gonna provide a short presentation on that program.
Thank you.
Vic.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, yeah.
I know. Chair Gray and members of the board, my name is Karen Steckling. I am a water resource control engineer in the DOD program, and I'm joined today by my colleague Leah Lemoyne, who is the senior water resource control engineer of the water recycling and stormwater unit. Today we're going to present on our recent efforts, as Ryan mentioned, to develop and launch a mentorship program here at the Central Coast Water Board. So here's a brief outline of our presentation today. First, I'm going to go over the purpose and background with some background information, go over a timeline on developing the program, and explain the options available for staff to receive mentorship. Next, Leah will describe the Central Coast Water Board pilot mentorship program, share about our kickoff meeting we had in May, and lastly, provide an update on our current status and planned next steps. So what are some of our main purposes or intentions for mentorship within our organization? First is the transfer of institutional, professional, and leadership knowledge to create opportunities to coach employees to achieve their goals, whether that be career, leadership, professional, or personal development. And lastly, to establish an office culture that encourages ongoing and continual learning and a growth mindset, and also one that develops belonging amongst one another in alignment with our organizational mission. So here's a little bit of background about why we're here before you today. Ryan mentioned some of this, so I'll go quick. But as has been mentioned a few times, we've experienced a lot of retirements, new hires. Actually looked yesterday, and we're at 30% of our workforce has been here less than 5 years, with 70% of us here less than 10. And so during this time of change, we really need to manage flux and maintain continuity to maintain success as an organization. Succession planning is imperative. As also mentioned, we operate in a hybrid work environment, which can potentially limit opportunities for for organic mentorship to form and cross-program collaboration to naturally occur. And furthermore, as mentioned, we find ourselves in a more complex and dynamic work environment with shifting priorities, regulatory plans, policies, learning how to engage tribal communities, advocate for environmental justice, pivoting to address emergent new threats to water quality like emergent contaminants and climate change. And so because of all these reasons, or maybe even just due to personality, not all staff that are seeking mentorship within our organization have been able to find it organically. So we understand a lot of mentorship naturally occurs with direct supervisors, but we believe we can augment that growth with additional opportunities. Here is a brief timeline of recent events. I want to mention that since at least 2021, several staff here have advocated for developing a more structured mentorship program at Region 3. And then in November of 2023, State Board began a formal statewide mentorship program. And they shared their developed handbook that was complete with guidance on mentorship. This really provided an opportunity for us to build on what they had already put together and adapt the program to develop our own internal Region 3 specific pilot mentorship program. And we were able to receive that approval of mentorship kind of at the statewide level. So we formed an internal subcommittee and engaged with 4M and the seniors to determine what would be best for our organization at this time. And as Ryan mentioned, in the winter of this year, all staff participated in the workforce planning and development discussions, and those discussions did highlight mentorship as a priority, as a need, and as a tool to achieve our organizational goals. So we utilized the feedback and ideas from those conversations, discussions, and process to further inform our mentorship program design. And then in the spring, we were thrilled to be able to initiate our own internal mentorship program. We want to mention real quick, though, that there are several ways for staff to receive mentorship here at the Central Coast Water Board. And the first is through the organic mentor-mentee relationships that are already in place. We acknowledge that many staff have made strong connections that have allowed them the opportunity for valuable transfer of knowledge, skills building, support, and guidance. And we want to encourage anyone who finds themselves in this type of relationship to keep it up. And we also encourage staff to seek out new relationships towards this purpose. And as mentioned in the fall, last fall, State Board announced their intention to launch a mentorship program available to staff statewide. In this program, staff would be matched with mentors in other boards, offices, or departments, and that would provide them an opportunity to seek mentorship on a statewide level and gain broader perspectives and exposure to different cultures and leadership styles. And then the Central Coast Water Board Pilot Mentorship Program offers a third option. And this program, as I mentioned, adapts the statewide program to aim to make it even more accessible and relevant to staff here at Region 3. And now Leah is going to provide further details regarding our Central Coast Water Board Pilot Program.
Thanks, Karen. Good afternoon. I'm Leah Lemoyne. Tethered here. So I'm going to go into a little bit more detail about the pilot program that's been developed over the past, really kind of fleshed out over the last 6 months or so. So we created an application to participate in the mentoring program for the Central Coast specific pilot monitoring program. I'm sorry, mentoring program. Too much talk about monitoring earlier.
Oh, I didn't hear.
Thanks to Jesse Woodward and our admin team who helped us build out our application form and manage the data collection as part of that. So I'm not sure if you're here, but applicants could indicate general areas of interest that they were looking to mentor in or be mentored in, and those include professional development, interpersonal skills, leadership skills, career development, technical expertise, institutional knowledge, and job shadowing. And then the application had an opportunity for folks to drill down a little bit more specifically on what same process, what they would could provide in terms of mentorship and what they would like to receive in terms of being a mentee. And those were more technical skills or more specific skills related to both technical sides of things and interpersonal relationships. So conflict management and resolution, decision making, organizing others, project management, stakeholder involvement, communication, to name a few. So staff needs supervisor concurrence that this is a good time, would be a good time for them to participate in this type of program given priorities with the program and workloads. Matches were made based on general areas of interest and the specific request related to skills building. And we want to note that anyone can sign up to mentor. It's not just for senior level folks. There are a lot of veteran staff here that have a lot of expertise, and staff level to staff level, there's a lot of transfer that could happen there. The program is a one-year commitment, and management generously offered 2 hours per month or 24 hours over the year for the mentors and mentees to decide how to use that time, and that includes meeting time prep and the follow-up. So to create tangible outcomes, mentors and mentees were asked to make specific goals during their first couple of meetings and then track progress towards those goals during their time working together over the year. We had 24 individuals sign up. This gave us 10 pairs of mentors and mentees, and then we had 4 extra mentors, so they're on deck in case we need them. Most popular areas of interest for the mentees were identified here in the pie chart, and it was generally a pretty even mix between career development, job shadowing, institutional knowledge, professional development, technical skills, and a little bit of interpersonal development. And when asked, when we asked applicants for what specific skills they wanted to mentor or be mentored in, the 3 most popular subcategories were confidence building, communication, strategic thinking, recycled water and climate change. Sorry, those are 2 different things. Recycled water, climate change and sea level rise, and facilitation of stakeholder meetings. The subcommittee matched mentor mentees based on expertise and interest. So that was that process. And just to note, to go back to that third option, that middle option, the State Board statewide mentorship program, no one from our region signed up for that this year. We held a kickoff meeting in May. We shared meeting recommendations, mentor and mentee expectations, stages of forming relationships, best practices.
We utilized a lot of resources from the State Boards program that were quite good, and a lot of other resources. Just there's a lot out there. And we also had time for Q&A during this kickoff meeting. And we put all of the resources that we gathered on a SharePoint site so everyone has access to it all year long, and anyone can add or pull off whatever they find useful. We did a quick check-in. The subcommittee sent a survey to the cohort in September, so this is about 3 months in to the mentoring pilot program, to learn more about participants' experience and what is working or where there might be areas for improvement. We learned that most mentor-mentee pairs are meeting monthly, although there is flexibility to pick a frequency that works for each team. Over 75% of participants felt like they were able to identify clear and specific goals for this year. Many shared that they appreciate and value learning from experienced staff in a more meaningful and targeted way. And suggestions for improvement included adding additional resources on developing specific and measurable goals, additional resources on how to best structure the meeting time. And there was a request for a mid-year cohort meeting to kind of check in as a larger group and share best practices. So where are we now? We will be having that mid-year cohort discussion in January. We are continually adding resources and supporting the teams. And then after a year, so that would bring us to about June, we'll reassess based off of feedback of the participants, decide if it was valuable, assess the value, determine whether to continue as is, continue with some tweaks, or not continue if that's what the feedback tells us. So we'll just decide at that time. Questions?
Yes, Ms. Hoskins.
I have one. It actually might be more of a suggestion. First of all, this sounds really impressive that you've taken this initiative to do this. I once was a commissioner on a state public utility commission in another state, and I was involved in a similar effort where it was for public utility commissioners around the world, actually, if you wanted to be a mentor or a mentee. And I said, I'll be either, because I was new, just like I'm new here. And it turned out that another commissioner in another state did the same thing. And they connected us, even though like we both were the same thing. We could either be a mentor or we could be a mentee because we had different experiences in our lives. And it actually ended up being incredibly helpful to me, which is a long way of saying that I would encourage you to think about the state board, people to think about that option. It's different, right? Like this one you've developed seems incredibly helpful for like transfer of information and skills here, the central board, but there could be somebody in the state program who's doing a similar type of function that you could mentor each other, you know? So it's just maybe something to think about when you do that review, that mid-year review. And now, you know, because we have the ability with Zoom and everything, I mean, that's how I did it with my colleague. I mean, we weren't getting together to do this. It would have been nice, but, you know, we just did at that time, I think, you know, monthly phone calls. But we were in a very similar kind of situation where we were really able to help each other. So that was all just to encourage, since so far nobody has signed up for that option, could be something helpful for some people. But thanks for taking this initiative.
I totally agree. I hope we can get some participation in a statewide program maybe in the next round, because other regions do things differently, maybe sometimes better. Maybe we need to know about it. So I think there's a lot to learn there. Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to say thank you for doing this. I've been very fortunate in my career to have some exceptional mentors. I'm sure I disappointed one or two along the way, but that's a different story. Going back to slide 8, I think it was slide number 8 with the pie chart, I was very intrigued that with the exception of interpersonal development, you know, there are differences, obviously, but they all seem somewhat equal or close to being equal. And, you know, job shadowing, professional development, all of that is very important to our workforce. And again, I thank you for doing this. This is something that will help hopefully retain staff, because as we all know, it costs a lot more to hire somebody, train them, go through the whole process than it is to execute some personal or professional development programs and keep them well trained. Thank you. Thank you, Brian.
Thank you, Chair Gray. Building off of Board Member Hoskins' comments, I'm curious, do we know why, was there ever a discussion about why people are hesitant to sign up for the State Water Board Mentoring Program?
I got the sense that, I don't want to speak for people, but the opportunity to mentor with someone who you will work somewhat closely with, or at least already have a baseline level of comfortability with, versus a complete unknown with State Board. You could be paired with who knows, and and who knows where, doing who knows what.
And so how much benefit.
Right.
Yeah.
So I think it seemed a little, maybe a little hard to sort of pin down the cost of time to the benefit that you might get out of it. So that's my suspicion.
Mm-hmm. Karen?
Yeah, I'll just add, I think that, the in-person kind of opportunity that would, you know, benefit someone by choosing the Region 3 specific program. And also we were doing something new. So I think that people were eager to participate in this. Mm-hmm. I think the State Board, we didn't go into it that much. It's a little bit more rigid. Mm-hmm. And so there was required monthly meetings, required notes to be submitted, and it was a 1 year and then you graduate. And we tried to build in a little more flexibility in our program. Like I said, an ongoing learning. And so maybe if it's working, it continues after a year. That relationship doesn't end.
Right.
So I think that that maybe was also intriguing to folks and they were more interested in that. But again, we haven't asked that question. That's a good one.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad to hear of the enhancements that are gained from the one-on-one in-person.
Yeah. Right.
And the potential to continue that relationship less formally, but building a strong rapport with someone who you respect going both ways, right? Because often I have found in working with new staff and folks younger than myself, they have a very different approach. They have different technical skills and their problem solving is not so locked down, and sometimes more innovative ideas come from people who don't know that we never did it this way before, you know, and so ideas might germinate there that are worth talking through. They may not be possible, but elements of it may be pulled, you know, out of a good idea and then moved into action. Also, I was curious if the resources you're referring to are developed from that State Board program, and so you can pick and choose from those materials. Those are all available.
Yeah, they shared their kind of their program with us, and it, like Leah mentioned, we thought it was quite good, so we kind of ran with that. I will just offer the State Board program also had rigid requirements on who could be a mentor. And so they required that the mentor be two classes above the mentee. And based on memory, I believe they only had 5 to 7 statewide. So it ended up being a pretty small cohort for this first year for them. So I'm hopeful it can continue and get more engagement and maybe they can tweak too, because I think that the people that are two classes above staff tend to perhaps not have time available to be a mentor.
Yeah.
And like Leah mentioned, we kind of made it more equitable. Anyone that felt like they had something to offer could sign up as a mentor. I looked at the data and we had about half and half. So about five were on, you know, senior and above, and five were staff mentors.
And that brings me to my last question, and that is mentoring or professional development for upper-level staff. Is that a component of this, or is that to be developed? What do we see about that?
Well, I can actually speak for myself. The Water Leadership Program that the State Board puts on I just recently attended the 400 series, and it had similar components where you were paired up with somebody and you worked on a project together, and I found it invaluable in giving you that time and space to read leadership articles and kind of assess where you at. And there are various training opportunities through the state board for that. But as we mentioned, we're still kind of evaluating the survey for the seniors, and then maybe that is another component.
Thank you. Ms. Harlan, any questions or comments?
Yes, thank you very much. I love the mentorship program. I think it's fabulous, and I'm so happy that we have so many participants, and congratulations to all of you for being open to something new. I think it'll be very valuable, and I hope we continue it. I think it's wonderful. Just to comment on the previous item, I attended a workshop some time ago about how an organization can deal with reduced resources, that is budget cuts, and what you should do. And what that expert panel recommended strongly was to keep the professional growth going in your organization. Keep sending people to workshops and classes, because this hopefully will not last forever. And when things improve and you get more staffing and you have more time to work on more projects, you will have staff that is better educated, that is motivated, that is ready to meet the challenges that will come up in the future, because they've been brought along with this professional development. So I think that's, I just want to put a plug in for that I think that's very valuable. The panel said, in this time of shrinking budget, don't cut back on your professional development of your employees. Send them to more classes and workshops than before, because it will pay off in the end. Thank you.
Thank you, Board Member Harlan. So we're done with our presentations, correct? So I can now,
speak
sort of for this entire item. And it's obviously been a long and lengthy and an extremely important item, really from tip to tail, just understanding the breadth and the depth of the programs. Everybody that's working on all of the critical health and safety, water quality issues that we have here in our region and in the state. And so I just want to recognize every single one of our staff members who is pretty much toiling every day at this point, sort of against the odds, it seems, with reduced staffing and budget to not only meet the challenges that come at us, but also anticipate new ones and then work across programs to be innovative and get high quality, high caliber work done. And so just want to appreciate each and every one of the staff members, as well as the leadership team that helps to pull this together, you know, build morale, vision out the next steps, and then also laud you all for the mentorship program, which I think is really critical personally and professionally, and I think will just reap tremendous dividends. So kudos to everybody. I value you all and really appreciate seeing you all here, hearing from you, and just all the work that you do every day in the communities and throughout the region. So those are my comments. Thank you. Yes.
I do want to acknowledge that we have a really strong and resilient staff. I really am very fortunate to be able to work with this group. Every day I learn something new, and it's very inspiring. It's motivating to work with this group. And I did want to acknowledge the board. I wanted to thank the board for engaging in this conversation and understanding that we have a lot of work on our plates, and the key part of what we're trying to get at with the strategic plan is that we will have to move things around, and just to you know, be patient when we do, and understand that we are carefully considering what we're working on and what is not going to get worked on. It's all critical. I mean, it's when you're talking about water quality and public health and all that, it's really all critical. So they're very difficult decisions, but we take it very seriously. And I also wanted to thank the staff. I mean, we couldn't do this without the staff. As you said, the presentation, all the work that went into the strategic plan comes from the staff and the work that they do. So I just wanted to acknowledge them and appreciate the work that they've done.
Thanks. Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And I think it's really important because you do have a community here, a community of people that are all dedicated to the purposes and dedicated to one another. And that's a tremendous resource. So the resiliency, I think, is really a reflection of just how the quality of people that you have here on staff. And so I think it's important that we maintain that and continue to build that. So I very much appreciate everybody's effort and all that. Any other questions or comments? Yes? No? Okay. 12:37. Dare I say we may adjourn right now. Thank you so much for these 2 days.